Stage 1 LRT Agreement Update Mise à jour sur l'accord de projet relatif à l'étape 1 du projet de TLR. Monsieur Manconi, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, FEDCO. The two parts to this presentation, the first I'll update you on LRT Stage 1, the Confederation Line, from a project agreement perspective, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Morgan, who'll give you an update on Stage 2. So, Mr. Mayor, members of committee, progress is being made on stabilizing the service with the Confederation Line. Our priority continues to be on improving service for our customers, and we are in continuous interaction with RTG and RTM to ensure that their focus is aligned with making sure that we have consistent, reliable, safe service for our customers. The four main issues where we are focusing with RTG is ensuring that they stay aligned on resolving the issues that we've talked about in the past, which is the train control monitoring system, door operations, the vehicle on board controller, and track switches. Also, in terms of ridership, because I know there's been some comments about some of the disruption to our service, has that affected ridership? The data that we have so far indicates September to September comparison from last year. We're at 3.7% more ridership overall on the entire system. October, we're about 3.2% higher overall on the entire multimodal system. And for the 12-month period, we're just under 1% increase for the entire system also. So that is promising, and hopefully that continues. I'm now going to go through those four issues and give you an update in that regard. The number of occurrences associated with the train control and monitoring system where it's causing disruption to the service, particularly in the AM and PM peaks, is trending downwards. There are a number of things we've done with RTG, RTM, and Alstom to assist in this regard. First thing is there is software that's been deployed on all of the vehicles, and that software does two things. It contains the issues that are generated by this situation, so it minimizes the impact. And the second thing it does is it collects critical data, which is passed on to the engineers and technicians that are looking at what's what the root cause could be and ultimately looking for a root cause solution. In addition to that, we've implemented a bunch of measures that enable a very rapid response to reset the system, no different than resetting your computer at home. There's a procedure to that when this TCMS issue arises, so that minimizes the disruption, and when it does occur, in some cases, it's not even noticed by anyone. Although the root cause is not determined, these combined measures have reduced both the number of incidences and the impact to service. And that international team of experts continues to be on the ground assessing and looking for root cause. So from a statistical perspective, this is a graph that demonstrates the number of TCMS events that caused delay by week since we've launched. And you can tell we, in mid-October, towards the end, that's when we spiked, and things are trending downwards in terms of occurrences, the number of occurrences, and the number of occurrences that are impacting services. So we're containing it, and we're continuing to work on the permanent solution. In terms of door operations, again, a friendly reminder that you will always have doors interrupting service on any system around the world. 50 to 60% of rail disruptions in urban settings are associated with interactions with doors or doors going into default mode. That's normal, that those are safety features kicking in. Our door faults are being managed very, very well, so much so that it's virtually invisible in many, many cases to service. Unfortunately, and please, I'm not blaming customers, I'm sharing information, and we're going to be tweeting out very proactively. We had three delays last week where it was a direct result of customers forcing and prying open the doors. and we're going to amp up our Twitter campaign. We're putting additional signage in the vehicles. The customers need to leave the doors alone, because especially when they force them open, that can cause them to go into default mode, and then there's a full reset that needs to occur with those doors. We are rolling out the adjustments on the sensitivity associated with the doors. That's going to be worked on in the near future. We have a line of sight on how to do that. We are adjusting dwell times continuously, and that's right down to seconds in terms of adjusting that so that there's ample time for people to board and exit the vehicle. The impact of the severity of the door faults and how we manage them has significantly decreased in terms of impacts to the customers and to delays of service. So we've got this in a good space. We need to continue to stay on top of RTG and RTM to make sure that they manage this accordingly and do those adjustments that we've been looking for. And we're going to continue to enhance our communications out to the customers. So that's how it looks like from a stats perspective. It's up and down all over the place. Last week is, we would have been a lot less had we not had those three interruptions. And these are where the door events are causing a delay. Again, we're doing door isolation, which means the operator goes and isolates the door that's been interrupted, and we continue with service with minimal impact. That's literally down to minutes in terms of that operation. So there are occurrences happening on the line. We're just managing very well with our staff and with RTM staff. The vehicle onboard controller, that's the Thales controller system. That it's like your GPS on your vehicle. Fortunately, these are not major impacts on the main line. They're still occurring in the maintenance and storage facility. So when we're getting ready for deployment of trains and so forth, there's a direct link to the TCMS issue. So that working group, those engineers, are correlating the interplay between these two systems and making sure there's no issues. Very minimal impact out on the line. And as you can see by the data, there's some days, weeks that there's zero of them. We peaked at four occurrences in October, but again, we're trending in the right direction, and it's being managed very well. So on the main line, this is not a major contributor to interruptions to service. In terms of track switches, as you know, we had a bad week about 10 days ago where the track switch at Blair went into fault mode. And unfortunately, that was because RTM didn't have their guideway tech there like they were supposed to in the rush hour period. There's two switches that are very critical, Tunney's and Blair. And you've all ridden the system. That's when they do the crossover move. If those switches aren't fully operable, they go into a fault mode, and there's certain safety precautions we need to do. We've had a frank discussion with Peter Lausch. Those technicians that they committed to having them there for the AM and the PM peak need to be there. So the disruption that we saw about 10 days ago wouldn't have occurred if that technician was there on time, and unfortunately he or she wasn't. They're on top of that now. They're managing them well. We're seeing the technicians there for the AM and afternoon rush hour. The switch covers that were a problem early on have been removed. And they've added extra resources in the event of snow and ice. And all those switches have heaters, by the way, that are monitored from our control center, so they melt the snow and ice. But as a precautionary measure, we've insisted that they have additional technicians and maintenance personnel if it rains, snows, or freezing rain for those switches, because they are so critical. So in terms of that data, again, the week of the 17th into the 24th, that would have been a flatter line had they had the technician in place at Blair Road. So what that means is when you look at it from an overall performance perspective, you're looking for zero on this graph is what you're striving for, which means your railroad operates at 100%. There's no railroad in the world that does that. This is the percentage of kilometers missed by week, and you probably can recall the spike of that 6%, which was the week of November 11th. That's when we had the track weld issue. We had to slow down train operations, which means fewer trips, which means congestion on the line and so forth. We're in that 2%, which means you're operating at about 98% of trips out there. That is very, very high. And I'm not at all dismissing the interruptions to our customers. I'm not minimizing that. I'm just sharing with you the data, and we are, as it's trending down to the bottom right, had that 6% not been there, that's what we're encouraging and forcing RTG to focus on, to drive down those trips missed overall. So in terms of taking care of the customers, we're enhancing services. We're thinking outside the box in terms of what we can do in the event of rail disruption. We have the 40 additional buses that we've deployed citywide, which will get codified into the January schedule. Those are yielding positive results. We have the 20 dedicated R1 buses that we deployed yesterday in the event of rail disruption so that we don't have to bleed off of your routes. We have the additional 19 buses for your consideration in the budget. The O-Train ambassadors are being extended, and we have the improvements to stations and trains that you've heard about, everything from strap hangers to weather protection and platform changes and so forth. So the funding for service enhancements, this is the project agreement piece. As we know, RTG has not fulfilled the contractual obligations. They are required to deliver consistent, reliable service at very high standards for our city. We are exercising our rights, and there are many rights in the project agreement that are very straightforward and black and white. We have expert legal advice, both internal and external, guiding us every step of the way in terms of what we're entitled to do in terms of managing this for our customers, for you, for our city. We are deducting payments to the monthly service payments based on their performance, and we're fully entitled to do that. It's not like we have to ask. That's an entitlement. It's clear in the project agreement. If they don't meet certain performance standards, we do deductions. So those deductions are funding a lot of the initiatives that we've been talking about. The project agreement also has various tools that we can use to ensure that the customer is protected, the taxpayer is protected, and we're invoking those rights. We have two specific mechanisms that we're rolling out immediately. The first is conducting an operational review, and the second is enhanced maintenance oversight. And what those means is we have the right to go in and look at any document, any contract, any matter that we want to look at to understand their operation, any aspect of their operation. And what we are going to be looking for are gaps or concerns or things that need to be rectified, and RTG has an obligation to meet its requirements under the PA. So those gaps, which will be or issues, if they're identified by our experts, we will bring them immediately to the attention of RTG, and they have to bring forward a plan on how to identify address those issues. The second issue is enhanced oversight. And what that means is we get into their business and look at what they're doing and how they're doing it. With rail experts that we have that are at our disposal, we're looking for gaps, concerns. This is the how are you doing things, how frequently, and I'll make it real for you. We can go in and we're going to ask, let's demonstrate to us your maintenance program on switches. How often are you inspecting them? Are you using the appropriate grease? There is different grease for winter operations and summer operations. What schedules do you have your technicians on? What's your resource deployment? Do you have all the proper tools and equipment for that? And so we will be going in certain areas very, very deeply to ensure that we're comfortable to take the necessary steps forward to identify those gaps. And again, under the project agreement, they have obligations to meet, and we'll be directing them to address those issues in terms of correcting those things. So the next steps, Mr. Mayor, members of the committee, is we're going to immediately issue our operational review team. We're going to also put our experts out in the field. We already have a level of oversight on the vehicle maintenance aspect. This goes deeper and goes across any area that we want to review. I'll now turn it over to Mr. Morgan for his presentation on stage two.
I think we'll just hold, we're going to do questions on stage one and then come back to stage two. I noticed in Kitchener-Waterloo there, they had a snowstorm, ice storm, and the ice built up on the overhead wires, and they shut the system, the main system down. I think it's called the ION, I-O-N system. What are we doing to ensure that doesn't happen? We've been relatively fortunate. We haven't had much of a winter so far, which is good news, except unless you're a skater or a skier. But we want to ensure we have overhead wires as well. How we ensure we don't follow what happened in Kitchener-Waterloo?
So we have a winter plan for different various winter conditions that RTM has filed with us. And on ice, that if that were to occur overnight in particular, we would continue to run limited service through the entire corridor to eliminate the ice buildup on the overhead catenary system.
Thank you. Councillor Harder, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and thank you, Mr. Manconi. And I wanted to thank Councillor Hubley as well, who, as the chair of the OC Transpo, I've certainly appreciated, you know, from a political perspective, to have you as the point person and how hard you've been working on that. So thank you. Councillor Suds and I were just talking about the fact that we are noticing a decline in the number of people that are in the morning, in the afternoon, consistently talking about failure, what failure looks like, taking pictures, taking videos, etc. So that tells us that without a doubt we're trending the right way. I have a question on the track changes slide that you had up there. You were talking about the technician didn't show up, and so that was a... Would we not be able to have all this as programmable, and would in today's time it be necessary to count on a person to actually activate that?
Mr. Chair, yeah, so it's not about activating the switches. The switches are all automated. We've asked for, because those switches are so critical and they had early failures associated with the switch covers, we asked to have technicians stationed there in the event of a failure of those switches or a problem with those switches. So when it happened 7-10 days ago, the switch didn't fully open automatically. You have to go there with the technician has a procedure to go there and check it and make sure it's fine, reposition the switch and so forth. So it's a proactive measure. All the switches are automated. They function with the CBTC system.
That's great. And another thing that I would say, if it's possible to focus messaging on, for example, the changes you're anticipating in January with the extra buses that come on. For example, the buses that will go from Tunney's to Kanata, Eagleson, or Tunney's to Fallowfield are absolutely critical. And I know for a fact that people are hanging on by their fingernails to the fact that it's only this number of days left to do that. That's a game changer. That's a game changer for the people we represent, without question. When you think about the number of buses that are available to go in the direction to Bayshore, in the direction to Baseline, to take 100,000 people and the riders of 100,000 people and more, because Stittsville is also part of that, or in my case, 100,000 people and including Councillor Meehan's part of Barrhaven. You take that number of people and to have them on a Pony Express is not realistic, because too many people who don't need to go to Fallowfield, don't need to go to Eagleson, are getting on anything that they want. So my point on the messaging is it's confusing, because we did have a bus that was jumping and going from Tunney's to Fallowfield, and that seemed to be working well, and you had one as well. But like yesterday I had from somebody saying, I thought all the buses were going, are the 270 series supposed to stop at Baseline? Okay, now we stopped at Majestic. The bus number is, four letters. Sportsplex 2, seriously? And so that kind of stuff, I think it's really important. What should they be expecting? At perfect scenario, what should they be expecting? Because that's what they're hoping for. Like, that's what they're waiting for. And I think that will you know, buy us continued support of our service and make it more reliable.
Councillor, I agree with you 100%, and we are going to be giving all of you a very precise scripted memo on what the changes are by routes, so that you'll have that well in advance. And then our comm strategy is to push out exactly what you're talking about, because with the 40 buses, a lot of them were filling in gaps, and so there is some of that confusion out there. That was a calculated risk that we took because we wanted to provide the service rather than miss a trip. We are going to do, you know, if I could call it that, resetting or that clarification as to what routes specifically go where. And I know many other councillors have asked me, when do I know the exact changes for January? It's coming. There's a whole team working on that, and I agree with your point. It has to be crystal clear to everybody, both to your offices, to the customers, on our website, social media, and so forth. And we're sequencing all that because we've got other messages that we have to communicate out. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to go to manual door operations for winter. We're worried about information overload, and so it's deliver great service, get the communication part right, all in parallel, and try to do it all together.
And I think you can count on each of us to individually know how to get that information out to the people that we serve best. And then you don't worry about that. I mean, you're going to come up with a package that fits the whole system. But really, whether it's Councillor McKenney or Councillor Brockington, myself, Councillor Kavanaugh, Councillor Dudas, individually, I think it's the best way of getting the information out and the people having the confidence in that and understanding that, okay, so this is about Barrhaven. I'm not going to be telling them about Orleans Ward. I'm not going to be telling them about West Carleton. If they want to go there, they can find out that information. But I think that just to make it really easy, do the best you can at giving us the wordsmithing that we can actually just pound away at it, so people, even in the busy time of Christmas, can actually catch on to the fact that, okay, that's great. By the time I come back from my Christmas holidays or my whatever I'm doing, or we were away skiing or whatever, I know that this is going to happen for me. And I think that would go a long way. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Councillor. Councillor McKenney, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and thanks for the update and the more regular updates that we've been getting. It certainly has been helpful in terms of responding to some of the inquiries that we're getting into our office, so I thank you for that as well. Just want to ask about the number of drivers and the training between now and January. How many new drivers are you having to bring on, and how is that training happening in what seems like a shortened period?
So we just screened, I believe, because we had to book Tom Brown Arena, 160 operators. They're going through the process. Remembering, I think our failure rate's 20% to 30% on that. So we're definitely over the 100 mark in terms of what we're trying to lock down. We put together an integrated team of HR, ourselves, and others, MTO, and we're working. We've never done this before, actually. We're going through the weekends. We're actually looking at split shifts for training and so forth. We know we have enough resources to go with everything that's been put before you, which is the 40 buses, the 19 new buses in service, and the 20 on replacement service. What we need to do is build up what's called the spare board, which is in the event someone calls in sick or we're short on operators and so forth. So that's what we're pushing towards right now. And we have trainers that we're even looking at bringing back, trainers that have retired, and get them recertified to help us out. We've reached out to other agencies. They're offering us training trainers in January. So our goal is to bring, I'd say, over 100 operators back.
I guess I'm thinking more about timing. What is a normal time frame for training a new driver? So let's say I apply to be a driver, you bring me in, I make it through that 70%. What is the normal time frame for training me to actually go out then, turn on that key and start to move passengers around?
There's a number of things. I believe off the top, the MTO days is 36. And so it's around 6 weeks start to finish, but that's just using a conventional training regime of 8 hours and so forth, and not looking to, you can do road and you can do in classroom. And again, the team is looking at how we condense that timeline if we can.
So historically, we've always trained our drivers in about 6 weeks. And that's what we're looking at doing between now and January. Is that correct?
No, Councillor, it's varied. We comply with all the MTO rules on training. We've been audited. As you know, we went through a bus crash, two of them. We've had investigators in on looking at a lot. So I'm not sure where you're going in terms of what you're looking for in terms of the training. But
I just want to know how we're going to have enough drivers trained for January. I'm just not sure what that looks like.
So you're running the service right now with all of your service plus the 40. Plus the 20 on standby. Mm-hmm. There's 19 buses that we have to service. We have enough operators right now to do that. The challenge is we've got moves within the organization of backfilling some para operators, mechanics, and operators. So that's what we're doing now to the end of January.
Okay, thank you. Just switching back over to stage one, and I live very close, actually, to both Confed and Trillium Line. And, I think about Trillium Line often now because it does work so well, and we operate it and maintain it ourselves. And I just wonder what the overall performance, say, in the last, I don't know, year, 2 years, 3 years, has been for the Trillium Line.
Actually, correction, Councillor, we don't maintain that ourselves.
Okay.
We just operate it.
We operate it?
Yeah.
Okay.
The maintenance of the vehicles is contracted out. The tracks are contracted out. The switches are contracted out. The communications is all contracted out.
Okay.
And the performance of that, I'm glad you brought that up. It's around 98%, 99%, 99.5%, 99%. It's very, very high. But I will remind you of the launch of that, because I know I was sitting there with the former chair. It was a very, very rough start. And we went through many months of trials and tribulations with switches and all sorts of things, too, in terms of typical ramp-ups. But, Trillium Line is a great performing line. It's stabilized. It went through its teething pains. And we operate it, and the maintenance is contracted out.
Okay. Sorry, I was mistaken there. And you mentioned last meeting that we're to expect track heaving on the Confederation Line. And again, I go back to the Trillium, and I know we can't make a direct comparison, but my understanding is that the tracks are similar. Tracks are tracks, right? We've been laying tracks in this country for a long time. So I just wonder, like, have there been track heaves and weld cracks on the Trillium Line?
So I'll say one thing, and then I'm going to turn over to Mr. Morgan, who knows this like the back of his hand. A track is not a track is not a track. There's different gauges. There's different widths. There's different heaters. So on Trillium Line, you've got gas heaters. On the Confed Line, we have electric heaters. But I know that there was inquiries about comparing the heaving and the track welds on Confed to Trillium. I'll get Mr. Morgan to comment on that.
Okay.
So a few years ago, at Trillium Line, Carlton in particular, the passing siding at that location, we had the original spring switches that were installed in 2001, and those switches for a number of years, due to fouling of the ballast and other issues, did suffer from heaving, and that's why that particular location, that's why for a little while, we were having problems on the Trillium Line. We did, through some PTIF funding, we were able to replace those. Replace all the ballast, so clean ballast. So the heaving issue at that location has been corrected. I'll talk a little bit about the Trillium Line first and then go to the Confed. In terms of the track is continuously welded rail. It was replaced a number of years ago when the pilot first opened. They used the original rail, which was bolted. That was swapped out to continuously welded rail, which needs to be installed and set at the correct temperature. Otherwise, you do suffer from sun kinks in the summer, which we do see on the Trillium Line. There is a problem in a couple of locations where, in high heat waves, we slow the track down, You know, we've been fortunate that we haven't, in the opposite, in the winter months, we haven't seen any rail breaks on that track. And so it's really a question of mitigating the summer performance. So that's the Trillium line. The difference on the Confederation line, we have a number of tight curves that, you know, are essentially brand new rail. RTG is working to get essentially the neutral temperature, finding the balance between how to set up the rail for the cold winters and the hot summers in order to minimize the potential for a rail break or to minimize in winter or to minimize the potential for kinking or shifting a rail in the summer due to the high temperatures. Those tight curves near Herdman are, you know, they are seeing some challenges at those locations. They did take some rail out. They did put some rail back in. And then, unfortunately, a few weeks ago, one of the welds did break. Now, the system is designed to minimize the gap that's created when a weld fails so that you don't have a safety incident. That same type of setup, the advanced clips, minimizing the track movement, we don't have on the Trillium line. So you have a very good fastening system on the Confederation line. We just need to kind of get through this period of stabilizing the rail, making sure that RTG sets up the rail for the correct temperature that deals with both the hot summer months and the cold winter months.
Okay, I can appreciate that, but I just wonder then why that wasn't done when it was built. Why... So if I, and I'm not sure that I fully understand you, but what you're saying is you may have to take it out, you may have to reinstall, there's a perfect temperature at which it allows for expansion. Is that correct?
Councillor, all rail.
But I guess I wonder why that wasn't done by RTG to begin with. Like, why didn't they put it in at the perfect temperature?
No, they did, Councillor. The analogy is this. Just like a new house, when you move in, after the first year, you have some nail pops and drywall cracking, settlement of the house and so forth. All rail lines that go through extreme temperatures heat and contract. And the operations that we're doing, so last summer, unbeknownst to yourselves, they actually had to go in and cut a rail. They just cut it, and that releases the tension, and the rail sets right back, and they re-weld it. This is done across the world where there's differential in temperatures. RTG did what they needed to do, and what happened the other day, and the term rail break sounds so catastrophic, it's not. There's a whole safety protocol associated with it and so forth. And what occurred there has happened everywhere around the world, and there's a response to it, and they did a very good job responding to it. And we will, I'll tell you right now, this spring, we're going to have track heaving, and we're going to issue slow orders. We do it all the time on Trillium. This happens everywhere. We need to get into this cadence and this normalization of railroad operations. The system has to find its equilibrium and go through four seasons of adjustments. Ballast will heave, settle, and so forth, just like a new road, just like your house does. So on the rail track, I'm not trying to minimize it, Councillor. This is all normal stuff.
So the Trillium line has had track heaves.
Yes.
And we all expect to see that again this spring
on Trillium?
Yeah,
you could.
Okay,
depends on the temperature. There's jurisdictions that actually take fire hoses out and cool the track down to get it to come down, and then when you do the repair, you have to wait till the middle of the night to bring the track down to a certain temperature so that the weld can adhere and so forth. So when we did that adjustment on the track last summer, it was in the middle of the night. It has to reach a certain temperature. There's a science to continuous weld rail.
Okay. Coming back to your go-forward plan, you said that you had a team of experts that you were going to do enhanced oversight and an operational review. So are those experts in-house today, or are they the experts that you brought in from externally, that the names that were given to Councillor Meehan?
Some of those names on that list, and they were propping that up with other experts also. And then we bring in specialized people, like, again, on the track issue that I talked about last summer, we brought in an expert on track from Chicago. He's probably the best in North America that understands just track geometry and track heaving and welding processes. So depending on what we find on the review, we'll start to bring people in, and we have a long roster of experts that have run, maintained, built, and managed railroads.
So that's for the operational review, but then the enhanced oversight, like, who will be the rail experts to do our enhanced oversight, and how long will they be with us? Like, what will that look like? What's the confidence that we have going forward?
So we currently have two full-time people at the MSF that rotate through there every single day, 7 days a week. They're looking at vehicle issues. On top of them, we're going to have an operational person that looks at operational movements in the yard, deployment, and so forth. On top of that, for 2 months, I have probably one of the leading rail maintainers for maintenance in North America. He worked in former New York City, and he'll be here for the month of December and January. And on top of all of those folks, I have probably one of the best individuals in North America that's currently works with STV that was on the list of that we provided to Councillor Meehan, who's bought more rail cars in North America than anybody else, has run the busiest system in North America, and knows CBTC, and the list goes on and on. We can bring in experts. So if we have a CBTC issue, Michael knows a CBTC expert that's on call and so forth.
And RTG will pay for that?
That's correct.
I imagine they don't come for cheap.
They no, you got to pay for the right talent, and RTG will pay for that.
And just one last question then. You just mentioned, and maybe it's more of a comment, that RTM didn't have the technicians to deal with the switches at the terminus stations. What was that? Did they give a reason for not showing up for work that day? It seems to me we're paying them an awful lot of money, and all eyes are on the system right now. Why would they not come out to pull those trains out of the terminus station?
So apparently the guideway technician was en route. I don't know if he or she got delayed. They weren't there. They need to be there for 3:30 to 6:30 is the period that they're supposed to be there. And I can assure you that Mr. Lausch, he spoke to myself, Mr. Kanellakis, and even the mayor that day.
And the trains, how are they? So when this technician shows up, what are they? They're just overseeing the trains. They automatically come out. Like, what does this technician do when they are at the terminus station? I'm just not clear on that.
So there's multiple technicians. They have technicians out on the vehicles. They have rover technicians. They can do anything, doors. They can help the operator reset the TCMS failure and so forth. The technician at Tunney's and Blair for the switches, they're what's called guideway technician. They're rail experts, like actual track. And that's if the switch goes into default or there's anything associated with the switch. So we have those people at the terminus stations. We have rovers throughout the system to respond to vehicle issues. And then they have more senior vehicle technicians on vehicles moving around so they can get to other locations.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Tierney.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First of all, I do want to thank John and your team. I think it was the last Transit Commission meeting I brought up the fact that Sevierville Station was one of the only ones that doesn't actually have a bus going to it. And then, of course, we saw a lot of the images from our riders that had to, you know, traipse through the snow, 800 meters down Sevierville, up Cummings. It was quite a stretch. I want to thank you for acting so fast. As of, I believe, yesterday, and please confirm this, instead of making that long, you know, pilgrimage to a bus stop, you can actually catch that R1 service right in front of Sevierville Station now.
That's correct.
And second, after I had made mention of that, I thought, well, we have a situation with platform crush at Blair, and any time we can reduce those numbers, that'd be great. And Councillor Dudas came over to me immediately after I mentioned, yeah, maybe there's some in the Orleans area, the Navin area we can look at. She came over, and we've been collaborating since. I did want to thank you. And, Pat, we've been meeting very intensely over the last little while about some opportunities over the next few months that could alleviate some of that platform crush and modify some of the routes from that area. But, of course, just we would want to consult with the public first. So I did want to thank you for that. I did have a question about these students. I think we have a really good opportunity here, and we're going to get a little bit of relief because students put a tremendous amount. We love our students riding our trains. They're going to put a lot of pressure on the trains, and they do put a lot of pressure on the trains. But as they head into exam period, the next 3 to 4 weeks, with holiday season and lack of students, I think we have a really good opportunity, or RTG will have a good opportunity to try to get a lot of this right. I just want to make sure that, first of all, RTG, are they going to go hard on this? Are they going to actually have everybody there? There won't be a lot of people taking Christmas holidays, which people are entitled to, but that's their problem. They got to figure that out. And second, will we be looking at maintaining a maximum train set? So not to go, okay, well, there's no students. Obviously, it's the holiday season. The trains are reducing. I think that would be a poor way to go. I think they should go full steam ahead, and I want to ensure that we're testing like we're in a full rush hour all the time until we get back after the holidays, and hopefully they'll have resolved a lot of those issues.
Councillor, on the train set, absolutely, I can guarantee you we're not reducing the train count volume. I hope ridership continues to be busy, and I hope people use transit and rail to go do their shopping at our great malls that are directly located along the line and so forth. And then we've got New Year's Eve that we want to promote and so forth, and Christmas festivities and so forth. So we're going to keep the train sets at the volume that they are at. I think there's some reduction of schedule hours like we do with bus and service. I don't know the exact changes there. On resource level, I will give credit when credit is due. Alstom has significantly increased resources on the ground for vehicle maintenance and warranty and so forth, as has RTG through their RTM arm. We met with Mr. Lausch yesterday. He walked us through the number of resources that they have added, and that's a very positive sign, and they're definitely listening to us. And again, I know it's difficult for some people. It's in their best interest to get this right because that gets them the money.
Completely agree. And on money, since you brought it up, just to reiterate, the extra buses, the red vesters, these are all coming from their side of the fence and not our side?
That's correct.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Mayor.
Thanks, Councillor Tierney. Councillor Brockington, just a reminder for the people who are here to speak for the budget, apologize, but we have a number of people that want to deal with this issue. So. It will be some time because we have, I think, eight people. So if you're here to speak to term of council priorities or the budget, it'll be a little bit longer. Thank you, Councillor.
Thank you, Your Worship, and good morning to everyone. Mr. Manconi, thank you for the update. Good to see progress and good work. What keeps you up at night? What are you worried about right now?
I want our customers happy, all of them. And they've been through a lot. And I'm concerned about our operators and our staff, all of them at OC Transpo. There's a direct correlation between the two. The whole team's been working hard for our customers, and our customers want consistent, reliable service. That's what keeps me up at night.
Do you share with your team, your employees who are putting in 110%, the same types of updates you give council? Do you give them the progress updates, let them know that there is progress, that their work is helping to achieve these objectives?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you. Can you just confirm either yourself or the city treasurer that all costs associated with the technical issues that we're having, all the expertise, all the extra work, all the labor costs, everything is covered as per the deductions we're making from our maintenance payments?
The extra costs will be covered either from the deductions that we're making or from the exercising of the clauses within the project agreement that allow us to recoup them from RTG.
So quarterly updates in 2020 from OC Transpo, end of the year 2020, we are not expecting to see budget overruns because of these particular additional costs.
You should not see overruns. My caution to you is this. You have built a significant amount of redundancy into the system. When the system is operating as it should under the project agreement, you will no longer be able to charge those costs to RTG, and council will have to decide at that point to eliminate the redundancy. If you don't eliminate the redundancy, you will have overruns in your budget.
Right. Okay. Very good. Very good there. Just going back to the doors, I think we have to differentiate between expected human behavior that's going to happen no matter how many tweets go out, no matter all the campaigns that we do, there's just certain behaviors that humans will engage in regardless of what jurisdiction you're in. I'm on the TTC once a month. When I'm down there, I'm on the subway. I see it all the time. But their door has the ability to almost adjust itself, right? Not all the doors have to reopen. It's whatever door has some sort of blockage can do that. So will we eventually get our doors to the point where they'll be able to recognize that type of interference, readjust itself?
Yes, we currently have three resets. So the door, depending on the force that you apply to it, cycles three times. The sensitivity adjustment calibration is the piece we need to concentrate on, and we're just starting to roll that plan out.
And can you confirm, I think there were stickers at least mentioned, or maybe they were put on and they came off, but I think maybe the most effective public outreach campaign would actually physically put a sticker on each door that basically has maybe, you know, a red line, circle, red line through it that basically says do not pry or do not adjust, something like that. So it's in your face, it's right on the door, I'm about to do it, oops, oh yes, I shouldn't be touching this. Has that been considered?
That's what we're going to roll out. I know, Councillor, you're on the Trillium line quite often. I think we have that exact sticker there, and we're going to do that.
Okay. Are we adjusting how we're going to manage LRT Phase 2 based on lessons learned from Phase 1? What have you changed with the entire Phase 2 process based on our experience so far since LRT rolled out?
I'll let Mr. Morgan speak to that.
Okay.
So I think one of the biggest changes is really the proving period right now with the vehicles. You know, all of these changes, whether it be, you know, simple changes like the strap hangers or software modifications, the TCMS software changes that will ultimately be resolved by Alstom, all of those changes get wrapped up into the vehicle fleet, the next 38 vehicles that we've purchased for Stage 2, such that by the time we get to Stage 2, we'll essentially be going into a testing commissioning period, a trial running period with a set of proven vehicles. You know, so we're using this period to work out all of those bugs with the vehicles. At the same time, we're taking a hard look at any changes, any, you know, capacity issues that we're seeing at the stations or any things with the, any characteristics of the stations that we're not happy with. We're looking at how do we roll those changes into the designs for Stage 2.
Good. I've got a number of questions related to Phase 2, which I'll just hold because I want to make sure that if there is an opportunity to learn from station design, carriage design, senior management oversight, testing, that we bring that over to Phase 2 so that in 3-4 years, no, we're not having the same type of conversation here. But again, I appreciate the update. Thank you.
Okay, Councillor Menard, please.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Thanks for the presentation this morning. We held a public meeting on transit issues about 3 days ago, and we had a lot of people show up. The public remains concerned about not just Stage 1 rollout, but the transit issues on the buses as well. And so they talked extensively about some of the areas that they're experiencing issues around missed bus trips and some scheduling problems. The LRT launch, they have a lot of potential solutions as well, though. They talked a lot about, you know, reducing the tie-ups at Blair and Tunney's, ways to spread out bus distribution and scheduling to alleviate backups with the R1 service, not just at those two areas, but in between. They had suggestions from sort of tech pros there on the apps and why the apps aren't working appropriately and what we can do to enhance the OC Transpo apps. Talked about shelter suggestions, scheduling suggestions, direct from some operators as well who have concerns and have ideas about how to fix these issues. And so I think there's a really cheap and easy win here. And it involves creating a community consultation group with average riders who have been experiencing these issues and have some solutions or suggestions for you. And it doesn't cost us any money. It's a good public thing to do as well because you can take the issues from a a subset of people that would represent the majority from all regions of Ottawa and work with them, bring in average riders. So I guess the question is, would you consider forming that type of a community consultation group during this critical period and bring in some of those average riders who have some of these suggestions? You really could benefit, I think, from this, and the system as a whole would be helped from all areas of Ottawa. So is that potential on your radar if that is a suggestion from council and committee?
Councillor, we already have that. And, you know, I saw some of the comments from that meeting that OC Transpo doesn't listen to its customers. The majority of the changes of the 40 buses came from your offices and customers. And we rolled out a portal on updates. You know, I'm hearing we're not informing people. There's a live, daily updated portal, and we tell people to send us their suggestions. And you're assuming that we're not listening to the customers and not taking their ideas and suggestions into account? I'm sorry, I have to be very blunt on this. It's the opposite. We're in the customer service business. I just got asked what keeps me up at night. It's the customers. We have 3,000 dedicated employees in that department who live and breathe on one thing, the customer. And we do listen to them, and the customer gets upset when we have to unfortunately say no. You know, I've talked to many customers, well, just put more buses out there and more. Well, that's about taxes, that's about costs, that's about managing the bottom line. And so you're assuming we're not listening to customers. We have that. We have a transit commission, and we have very accessible staff, and we do ward meetings, and we go and listen, and we solve problems. We just solved, literally overnight, Councillor Tierney's issue. That was one email from customers that went to him and said, we have a problem with this. Would you consider that? And a team quickly mobilized. So do I have time to set up another process to do public consultation citywide to hear ideas from customers? It already exists. But if council wants to direct us to establish a citywide process for listening and soliciting ideas, I'll take that direction from council.
So just I just want to clarify, because I feel it's a bit defensive here, and I'm trying to offer a suggestion that would, I think, help. And so with my office, there's been some good dialogue, Pat Scrimger and others, and we've solved some issues together, and you've been helpful in that, in me communicating some of the things that I'm hearing. But I get a lot of email about this issue, a lot of other suggestions that come in, and it is, I think, prudent to look at other options that exist out there to both do good PR and communicate with your riders who are critical and bring them in on the information that's necessary. So are you saying that the group that already exists is Transit Commission? Is that what you're saying? Or
no, I'm saying that I communicated to all of you that there's a portal that gives updates and also says, tell us every single idea from anybody citywide. And we have a whole team that tracks every single idea and suggestion and implements that, including the 100 inquiries that we had from council in 1 month on ideas and suggestions that came from your residents.
Okay, well, just to say, I'm not getting that back. We're hearing regularly from people that they send emails in, they're not being responded to over a long period of time. We have very simple route suggestions that have come in that have been very difficult since this changeover has happened to see progress on or get a response on. And the people that are talking about things like shelters and minor adjustments, if you bring them in during this time, it will be seen as a win, and it is a cheap win. And I guess I'm asking you, if you're open to that consideration, maybe we can have the discussion at a commission. But, you know, the feedback we're getting and that I hear from my colleagues as well, it's not that they're well-informed on these issues. It's not that they have been responded to by OC Transpo. It's not that they're feeling like they're being included in these solutions around paratransport and other areas. They don't feel that way. The majority of customers that I've talked to do not feel that is the case right now. So this is a simple suggestion. I don't want it to be a defensive thing. I really think you could benefit from doing this. So I'll try to work with you and see if we can't get something like this started in a way that will be productive for all of us. In terms of the stage one maintenance contract, I just want to be clear on this. There's a $4 to $5 million payment per month, right? And so can you tell me why does that vary? Why is it four or five or in between? What's the variance?
It starts off just over $4 million at the beginning of the 30-year concession, and as you move through, and the treasurer can explain, there's debt repayment and so forth, it peaks out around, I believe, $5 million. So it's over the journey of the 30 years.
And that's not just for maintenance. This is for other capital costs, or is that just for maintenance?
No, that's the 30-year concession period, and Marion can give you the highlights on that.
There's a number of factors that go into that payment. The largest part, I think, is actually the maintenance, and that's determined by the number of hours that are or kilometers that are driven, number of service hours, etc. Then there's also the repayment of the debt and equity that RTG put into the project. They get repaid that over the next 30 years. And there's also some SVP, special purpose vehicle costs, which is part of what we had to do to set up this arrangement. And there's insurance that gets they take out insurance, we repay them. So there's a number of factors that go into that payment every month, which is why it varies slightly from month to month.
Okay, what is the maintenance-specific cost then? You said that's the majority of it. What is that?
I believe the maintenance cost is roughly $2.6
million. Okay, $2.6 million per month. Okay. And then we've heard some of the issues are reducing. At what point are we able to add that additional train that we've talked about? You said once these issues are sort of getting close to being resolved, do you anticipate that by the end of the year? What is your new timeline on that?
So RTG is looking at adding two double trains, what you have right now, hopefully by the end of January. They don't have the exact timing. What you're going to see shortly are those trains out on the line being tested off-peak service with big yellow signs on them with the doors opening and closing, but you can't get on them and so forth. The balancing act that they're doing is a lot of the track time that's available for that testing right now is being utilized for the TCMS debugging. So they want to get the TCMS rectified, and then they can do the testing and commissioning of those two new double trains. If they get those in line soon, then the 14th train can be launched because they'll have appropriate counts and they won't have TCMS issues bogging them down. So it's tied in with the TCMS issues. It's not that we don't have the vehicles. It's about stability on the fleet and having consistent reliability out there.
Okay, that's very helpful. My last question on the Stage 1 piece is, on that 30-year maintenance deal, can that be amended or changed in the contract? Is there a different maintenance group that we could eventually select? If there is a possibility of amendment or changing, what is the financial penalty associated with that in terms of the one group?
You have a long list of tools to do many things when they're not performing. And that is a wide range of the actions we're taking right now. You can go in and replace portions of the organization. You can replace the entire organization. You're also the lender. You can do things that way. You have what some have characterized as the best P3 construct in Canada in terms of the tools at your disposal to protect the taxpayer.
Okay. So is there a penalty?
Your time is up. Your time is up. Thank you. Councillor Cloutier, please.
Merci, Monsieur le Maire. Merci.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and thank you, Mr. Manconi and Mr. Morgan, for your update.
Thank you to Councillor Menard. He asked the question with respect to trains 14 and 15, and thank you for that information. It's important because riders of the LRT know how busy it is, certainly at the very peaks. And we are happy that ridership is up, but it is very busy, and so the sooner those trains can get on the track, the better it is. We've spoken about a lot of issues and communication and the R1 buses, the availability of those when the LRT is disrupted, safety and the connectivity of the regular bus service. But I wanted to focus on the LRT itself and reducing the instances of door issues computer-based train control and the VOBC. Can you speak to us about, and you told us about the technicians that are being positioned a little bit better and the knowledge that OC Transpo and RTG are gaining from using the system, from operating the system and the information for our passengers. I'd like to see data, if possible, with respect to the amount of time it takes to reset a door. The resources are there. Is the amount of time to reset a door going down? Because I think that, as you have said, it will always happen. Door or mechanical or a computer, VOBC, computer-based train controlled issue will happen. The quality of our service will be in how quickly we can reset those issues. Any comments that you could provide on that?
No, that's a great question, Councillor. So doors, 3 to 5 minutes, if it's a isolation, so the operator has to get out of their cab, depending how crowded the train is, work their way to the door, and if it's the last door, it takes longer, hence the range. And there's a door isolation process so they can lock that door down and then continue the train in service. So get out of the vehicle, go to the door, use the special key, lock down the door, go back to the vehicle and start again. So we're doing that in under 5 minutes on the fly right now.
And is there not a technician? I have seen Alstom technicians on board the train. Are they not there to assist with that?
Yes, they can. They can also assist if there's a technician on that train or on that, you know, if they're on the first car or the second car, they will quickly mobilize and go and do that. They all have radio communication with each other. Okay. So that gets it even quicker.
What about with the communication issue, computer-based train control, the VOBCs, and when that, you have said that it happens, I believe you've said it happens more at Tunney's or at Blair, but of course it has an impact on the entire system. How quickly are those issues resolved to keep the train going?
So the VOBC, like I said, it's rarely happening on the main line. The TCMS failures or code fault happens predominantly at Blair, sometimes at Tunney's, and rarely along the main line. So that's a good thing. And what we did there, it's literally minutes, because what we do is at those terminus stations is we have the operator on one end of the cab. We have a technician that immediately goes into the other cab. And so the operator resets first. If it's not on that vehicle, the technician resets it on the other cab, so they don't have to walk down and do it. So it's a double cab entry immediately at Blair and Tunney's. So in the event that there's a TCMS issue, so it's a proactive move, that's got us down into minutes also. So by the time that train is loaded up, it's good to go.
So we haven't been seeing those issues so much on the line between Tunney's and Blair.
That's correct.
Between Tunney's and Blair since we've launched in early October.
There's been one instance on a few of the stations, and I think Bayview twice.
Okay. With respect to the door and providing information to our customers and making sure that people know about the doors, you had, and Councillor Brockington talked about it a little bit, stickers on the doors. I believe you were going to put some hangers on the train. Is that
The strap hangers are going in?
Not the strap hangers, information hangers with respect to the doors.
Yes, I believe that's part of it also. That and backpacks also, because we're having backpacks hitting the doors and so forth. So it's just an awareness program.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Merci, Conseiller. Councillor Blais, please.
Councillor Blais.
Just to tap into, I think, questions that Councillor Menard was asking, you had said that some new vehicles are coming in, or going to begin testing in the new year. So to confirm, those are vehicles 14 and 15?
No, we have 14 and 15. Those are already built. Okay. And we have even more from stage one. We have the full order. They're looking at getting additional vehicles so that we can put vehicle 14 out without the TCMS issue, and we have additional spares. So we're adding more to the fleet so that we can support customer volumes and make it more comfortable for everybody. And by the way, the testing will start in December.
Okay, so we'll have 14 vehicles on the tracks, and several vehicles as backup in the case of a breakdown or a swap out or what have you.
Correct. And if we choose to, we can go right up to 15 when those, you know, the backups to the backups are in place without the TCMS issue.
Perfect. So what kind of real-life improvements to the customer experience can regular commuters expect when 14 goes on to the into service?
What you'll see is, I think it's around 8:10 in the morning, Herdman will not be as congested, because you've picked up a lot of people from the East End going westbound. Tunney's will see additional vehicles coming in and out. So, again, right after 8, 8:10, that's when your peak of your peak starts to increase. So you'll just see a more comfortable ride, and there'll be more room on the trains, and it's a better customer experience overall.
Will it have any impact on the platform crowding at the bus platforms in terms of people arriving and being dispersed differently as a result of the extra capacity?
That's a great question. I think you'll see benefits across all modes, and you'll see less congestion, more comfortable on the trains themselves. And whether we go to 14 or we go to 15, there's pros to both.
So there's pros to both. Why wouldn't we just make the decision then to do it? Like, what's the reason not to do it?
Because if it can't consistently depend on a non-TCMS failure, so in the morning, if there's a vehicle 16, as an example, that they're trying to get out into the sequence, and it has a TCMS failure in the yard, it just stays there. We don't want to risk the vehicles in service. We're trying to get 13 vehicles that don't have any TCMS issues, and then they also have vehicle 14 and 15 on full standby. So, for example, this morning, just after 7, there was a vehicle issue. We swapped it out. Last night, there was a soiled vehicle, by the way, and somebody asked, what's a soiled vehicle? Somebody, unfortunately, urinated in the vehicle. We pulled that out. We launched vehicle 14 as the backup and so forth. So we're consistently getting 15 vehicles ready that don't have TCMS issues or have not experienced fault codes in the yard, whether it's a TCMS or a VOBC.
Are you keeping the two vehicles paired together uniformly, or have you been swapping the different vehicles together to create the trains?
They stay together as much as possible, but they do decouple them from maintenance and then recouple them and test them in the yard. And that's when you pick up the code issues, either the VOBC or the TCMS issue, when you're recoupling them.
I think at one meeting you had mentioned that RTG had not at that point yet had a yard master, like a harbor master for the train yard. Has that been put in place yet to help manage the flow?
They shared their reorg to Mr. Kanellakis and I yesterday. We like what we're seeing. We're getting our experts in to go a little bit deeper as to whether or not their examples like the position that you and I have talked about. I'm not sure it's there yet. I want to see it, and there's benefits to it. Okay. And they're doing some good improvements organizationally.
Perfect. So I like the new email that we're getting every day from you or Troy. I think that's very effective. I do have one question or concern, and it relates to some of the verbiage or adjectives that are used. I know this seems minor, but last night the update was there were no major delays or something like that that seemed to make it sound like everything went okay. And I know for a fact, at least in Orleans, there was at least one 45-minute delay to bus service. So I'm trying to understand, you know, is that not considered a major delay, or?
No, and I apologize for that, Councillor. On the bus service side, you're absolutely right, and I know you communicated out to me, as did others. We struggled with bus service yesterday. There were cancellations and delays that we haven't seen at that level in the past. We've been doing very, very good. And yesterday was a bit of a struggle, and it was because of so many weekend things. We couldn't get operators out and so forth on overtime and so forth. And I am speaking to Troy about that. He didn't do anything wrong. I'm just telling you that I think there was a bit of a there were cancellations, I know, out in the East End and some other areas.
Okay. Thank you for that. On the doors, the door starts to close. It touches my shirt or my backpack or whatever. It'll open, and it does that three times. Is that basically how it works?
That's correct.
But that, it touching my hand or my backpack, doesn't send it into fault.
That's correct.
It's when physical force is used to pry open the door.
physical force or your backpack, it closes on your backpack, you're not aware of it, and you push it, and that's that sensitivity adjustment that we have to do.
Yeah. So I appreciate the efforts on communication on Twitter. My concern there is that I don't think regular people are on Twitter. I don't know many working moms or dads in Orleans that are on Twitter. If they are, they certainly don't pay attention to it as perhaps as closely as you and me and the others around this table might. How are we going to proactively go talk to average Ottawa resident who's more concerned about getting their kids to hockey after work than, you know, following selfies that people on Twitter are taking?
Sorry, Kat, I agree with your comment. I'm not on Twitter myself either, although I read lots of Twitter accounts and get lots of tweets forwarded to me. But in terms of what context are you talking about?
You had mentioned that you're going to do an aggressive campaign about the doors on Twitter, and I'm wondering what else are we doing outside of Twitter?
No, that's a great question. So everything under the sun, including the cardboard door hangers in the buses at the stations, all those ad spaces in those stations, we have exclusive rights to those. We'll put lots of promotional material in there and so forth. And, again, through Councillor's office, we can get you information. You can blast it out through your emails and your distribution lists, newsletters, and so forth.
Have you done one of those you had those busology vignettes about perfume and all sorts of things. Do you have one about not doing this, like on the doors?
Yes. Yeah. We have the whole Trainology thing that we want to roll out on backpacks and doors and spacing and all that stuff.
Okay. On the extra buses and their costs, I know it's being paid for by the holdbacks, etc. I think it's clear that something is amiss in terms of what we thought would be the bus requirement when we originally did the business case, however many years ago that was, or what have you. Do we have to update the long-term financial model to account for this?
We are updating the long-term affordability model, yes, to incorporate this and a number of other things that have happened in the last little while. So we should expect to have an update probably by Q1 of 2020.
Okay, and given that, again, clearly there was some, you know, there's a difference between what the expectation was when we did the business case to the operational plan to what's happening in real life now with stage one, are we reviewing our assumptions about stage two at the same time as you update that plan?
Operationally, we are.
Yeah, in terms of how many buses we would need and the flow and et cetera.
Yes, both from a detour perspective and also an end state perspective. Recognizing the scope and scale of change is very much less. And you wisely chose as a council to set yourself up for stage two bus route extensions in stage one. So you set the network up so that stage two builds off of that. But absolutely, Councillor, it's back to the lessons learned and what adjustments and tweaks do we need to do and modify. So the operational assumptions, we're absolutely looking at that.
Okay, and just to confirm from the slide, the 19 buses that are intended to come into service, I appreciate their budget contingent. We have the vehicles and they're certified. It's really just the approval of the budget and the updating of the schedules?
Correct. Yeah, there's a big order of continual bus replacements that's coming on, including the bus detours for stage two and so forth. So the buses are arriving. We ordered those through the replacement program.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor.
Great. Thank you for that. Councillor Kavanaugh.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your report and the updates. From my residents, I actually don't hear a lot about the train. It's still about the buses and still a lot of concerns. I got emails this morning again, mostly it's about lateness and missing buses. It's still happening. Of the 40 buses that were put on, you mentioned routes that were going to be covered off. What flexibility is it? Because you're not mentioning ones that I'm getting emails about at all.
Sorry, Councillor, what was the question? I didn't hear.
The 40 buses, the extra buses, what's the flexibility of putting them in different places? Because you listed off some routes that were going to be helped, but you missed, like, the 87 is the big one that I'm getting a lot of flack on in terms of it being late and missing.
So I immediately followed up after the Transit Commission. Pat Scrimgeour is coming to see you to walk through those 40 buses and have any of them been deployed on your routes. And I also forwarded him the emails that you sent to me about concerns and issues. So we're doing a deep dive on those routes and those complaints and making sure that we get it right. So that for the January, he has the codification for January now. He can tell you exactly what he's going to be doing for those routes.
I appreciate that. One of the things that I'm hearing about is the accuracy of GPS when it says the bus is going to come. People are getting apps and they're, you know, it says when the bus is coming and it doesn't come at that time. What can we do about that?
So generally speaking, the next bus arrival on the text service has been very, very good. We gave you an update at the last Transit Commission. We did have our third party that hosts that had some technical challenges. So I don't know how dated, you know, the concerns are, but if you're getting those, again...
This morning.
Okay, let us know, and the specifics are important, so we can trace it back. We can go into the system and look back as to what route and why the delay and so forth, because we did have some technical issues with the third-party provider.
Yeah, I have a note here where someone waited 30 minutes for a bus that finally came at 8:39. The GPS said it would be there in 8 minutes, so it didn't work. And I'm getting messages like this on a regular basis.
Send that specifics to me, and I'll add that to Pat's list.
I really appreciate it, because one of the things I heard from my residents, and Councillor Harder won't want to hear this, so she should cover here wherever she is, because they want to jump on the 200 series buses because they see them go by, and they see them half empty, because their bus isn't there, they're frustrated. This is at like Lincoln Field stations, at the actual stations where they see them go by. So I feel like this is a lot of pressure. That's never come up before. So I just wanted to give you an idea of the extent of their concern is that these things happen. In terms of buses that have nothing to do with LRT, these are the 153. I've had residents still complaining that they're waiting over 30 minutes, and the majority of these people are seniors. I've had some of them write in and pass on their concerns to your staff, and one of the responses they got was if they feel that they're waiting too long, they should call paratranspo instead. I'm not making this up. That's the response they got, that when they complained about seniors having to wait for buses, up to 40 minutes sometimes, they were told, well, they should look at paratranspo so they can get door-to-door service. I was appalled because that response came from the staff. So we certainly responded to that back, but I will point that out to you, that it shouldn't come to that's the kind of response we're getting.
Well, you have my apologies, Councillor. I agree with you 100%. And I can tell you that in the new year, we're going to be bringing forward our customer service improvement program. We've done an assessment of the entire operation. I brought in an expert that's run call centers and service centers, and he's identified many of the gaps that all of you have brought to me in terms of responsiveness, the right level of resources, call waiting times, para-booking, all those things. So that's coming in the new year.
Okay. In terms of the 20 buses that are waiting at the stadium, is there any chance that they could maybe not immediately, but be prioritized as electric buses so we don't have them running?
No, they're diesel buses. And as I said, a Transit Commission, they have to be running. Otherwise, when you need them, there's a warm-up period for diesel buses. In terms of electric buses, you've approved a $6 million envelope. We're working with Ottawa Hydro and the suppliers on bringing you forward the electric bus pilot. So we don't have electric buses in our fleet right now, but you are getting a few of those that will be deployed out to service.
No, I'm talking about in the future, because there is a concern about having those buses running. With electric buses, we won't have that.
There is a premium to go to electric buses, and we've committed to bringing you a major report which ties into the affordability plan. Council needs to make a policy decision if you want to move to 100% electric buses or a mixed fleet and so forth. So we're putting that together. It's not It's not soon, it's coming, and there's massive replacements on the diesel side. So we've committed to bringing you that view both through the TMP and through the Transit Commission in terms of where you want to go with fuel alternatives. And just to be clear, there's people lobbying us to get into electric buses. There's people lobbying us to get into CNG, hybrids, and so forth. So it's all fuels that are on the table.
Well, we had a meeting yesterday with the sponsorship group on climate change emergency, and we're talking about zero emissions in, you know, like in 20 years. We're talking about working towards these goals. So I'm hoping that we'll be on transit will be on the forefront on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Lulof, please.
Thank you very much for your presentation today, guys, and thanks for your continued collaboration with us. You've done a lot of work for us in the East End. You've added supervisors to our two stations at Blair and Place d'Orleans. You've added buses to our 39 to Blair on the morning peak. You've added a route that connects the villages to Orleans Woods, to Convent Glen, Chapel Hill, Sunridge, and Innes. You've pushed through our Stage 2 Information Night for the East End, which is taking place this Thursday at Bob Macquarie. You take my calls at all hours of the day, John, and deep into the evening, and I appreciate that very much. Your team has accepted every single piece of feedback from my residents, and I know you're listening, and I know you're working hard, so thank you. It is International Persons with a Disability Day, and so before I ask my first question, I just want to share something that we've observed at Blair Station. At PM peak, a passenger with a guide dog was trying to navigate her way to Post E after disembarking the train. The overcrowding was so overwhelming that the dog couldn't move in the crowd at all. Thank goodness, Ottawa is full of generous and kind people, and somebody took her by the arm and walked her to the stop and stood with her until her bus came, so we're thankful for that. But Blair Station was not designed to be an LRT terminus station, obviously. But it will operate as one for the next 4 years. My question is, what improvements have been made at Blair Station since your last update to us? And what changes are you planning in the short term to deal with the overcrowding issue that we continue to see at peak periods?
So we have a multi-pronged approach. All of the East End councillors talked about the overcrowding to us. We've started, I believe, this week to get rid of some of the glass panels on the shelters. That's step one. We're going to watch that very closely. Step two is do we eliminate some shelters? But then you're left with the question of how do you shelter people from the elements? So I've got an amazing team looking at if we have to eliminate the shelters, can we put some temporary cantilevered ones to protect them? That opens up the entire area. So it's three phases of, and we're going to move quickly on it if it doesn't resolve the problem, all towards bridging us to the opening of Stage 2. So the goal is to improve the flow throughout that whole station. And if that doesn't work, then we have to take a serious look at whether or not we can encroach out into the paved portion. I didn't go there yet with the team because there's only so much they can handle right now. In fairness to them, they're looking at every option.
For sure.
So it is crowded, it is busy, and you know, it's what I tell RTG every single day. When it's a delay on the train. It's not just the delay on the train. Those terminus stations and Herdman take a big hit.
Sure.
And it's seconds. It doesn't take half an hour. It's immediate. You feel that immediate response. Last week or 10 days ago when we had to drop two trains at Sirville and those passengers had to come out of Sirville, that was a very busy, intense area. So I understand it. Multi-pronged approach.
Great. The three trips that you did add to the 39, are those additions going to be permanent?
I believe so, and this all speaks to what Councillor Harder, what Councillor Kavanaugh, and others are asking for. Pat's going to give you a list by ward, by route, before we launch the January piece. They literally finished it this weekend, so we're going to get you that information, and then if there's any questions on it, but I'm sure with all the extra service that we're adding, you'll see that we're filling a lot of those gaps. So it'll be route, time, and trip, and so forth.
You may have just answered this question, but with the next service change, will there be an augmentation to other routes in the east, like the 200 series routes? We've got the highest ridership in the city, but we're still experiencing capacity issues, especially at PM peak at Blair Station.
It's routes, trips, frequency, bus type, everything's on the table, and great. That's what we're going to get you. And if you don't see the level of detail when Pat gives you your list, we can meet with you, and he's got a whole team that can meet with you about that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Councillor Lulof. Councillor Dudas, please.
Great. I wanted to also add my congratulations on seeing a significant improvement. I know I take the bus and the train regularly, and since those 40 buses were added, I don't think I've missed a bus. There was some issues yesterday, but you know what? You've explained that, so thank you for that. But I have to say it has been a significant improvement. I also want to mention that your team has been absolutely wonderful. I've reached out to some of your staff, your frontline staff, who've been responding to residents directly, and just thanking them, as well as Ken Woods and some of your strong advocates on your team. So I do want to say that, you know, your frontline is amazing. Management has been great. I've been meeting with Pat, and that it's an ongoing process, right? And I don't know that we'll ever come to the end of it. I think that there'll constantly be need for improvements. But I'm very glad to hear around this table that, you know, we're asking questions about LRT, but we're also now moving on to the experience of buses. So it seems like we've kind of hit that stride, and we're starting to look to the future of how we're going to improve and expand. I did have a question, though, because, you know, your communications have improved. I have to say that has been great for councillors, but also for residents and customers. But, you know, I'm just going to give one example. Fouled train. There was a tweet that went out about a fouled train. I don't know if it was a typo. I'm not sure. But I have noticed there's a couple of tweets that are going out, a couple of shares that are going out, and people don't understand acronyms. They don't necessarily know the terminology. I don't know if that was a real word or if that was just a mistake. But I'm just wondering, do you have communications in place where it's real-world language, common language, that people can understand? As I said, it has been getting better, but I'm just curious as to whether you're working to improve that.
Yes, and that's the example I was citing earlier on. Unfortunately, last night at rush hour, somebody chose to urinate in a train. And so the person that put that tweet out should have said, bracket, urinated. You know, this morning we had somebody vomiting on a train. And so they use that's part of the challenge. Well-intentioned people, they're using these technical terms. So we've got people in there coaching them on make it conversational and make it plain English and plain French.
I'm pretty sure the city uses that for when a pool has been fouled as well, too. So it's, but we have to keep in mind that people don't always get the terminology. So I think, you know, as awful as your nation is, let's use the common language. I also want to ask a quick question in respect to the 131, the 231. I know I had a good conversation with Pat Scrimminger about how we can improve services to that. There have been issues continually, though, with packed buses on the 231. I will continue to work with Pat to find solutions, as well as Councillor Lulof, because the 131. But I think that there's opportunities, not just in my ward, but across the city, that we could look for buses that are maybe some of the redundancies. We can add more service to the routes that we absolutely need it. And I think that while we've started a very fulsome conversation with your team in respect to how we see things on the front lines, I think that there's more improvements that could be seen and experienced by our residents. So maybe I'm just highlighting that one route. There's a number of other routes that I'll continue to work with your staff on. But now that we've kind of hit that stride, now is the time to start looking for whether we can start rolling into better service and whether there are redundancies as well, too. Because as Marion pointed out, we're going to have to start picking and choosing pretty soon once we get a really fulsome LRT service as to how we can improve but start saving money as well, too. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Councillor Eglai, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. I have a question and a comment, I guess. Mr. Manconi, one of the suggestions that I've raised, and I've never really heard back from OC about, is I have a cluster of three communities, Manardale, Craig Henry, and Trent Arlington. Each has a bus that runs from Tunney's to their communities, which is ideal, but that bus isn't always there for a variety of reasons. We know there are issues around. So what happens is people jockey between the two platforms looking for the right bus to get onto, which clogs up between F and G, the two platforms, causes people to sometimes miss the bus because they can't get through the crowd. I've asked on several occasions for an explanation as to why we don't cluster the 282, the 284, and the 82 all at the same stop, which would help with Councillor Harder's issue of crowding, because some are now where the 270s go. So it seems to me it's an easy fix. I can't see that it costs money, maybe some sign changing, but other than that. But it would take away some of the congestion, I think, between F and G. So I don't know if that's something we need to talk about more offline or what have you, but I understand a similar situation was addressed in Councillor Tierney's ward, and there was a cluster of buses that were changed. So, again, I don't know if you have an answer today, and if you don't, that's fine. We can talk about it offline, but it just seems to me that that would be a simple fix. So that's sort of a question, a comment rolled into two, I guess.
It is on the list. Both you and Councillor Harder have raised that. It's a long, complicated process because it's about how buses go into that station and queuing up and so forth. I'm not saying you're right or wrong. I'm not passing judgment on it. There's supervisors that have given us suggestions on how to re-queue some of the buses. There's a very tense debate about, I've got some suburban riders that's saying the urban people should walk further and so forth. That's not what it's about. It's about how do those buses get staged in Tunney's and at Blair so that they flow operationally as best as possible. Remember all that testing that we did? There is a science to that. We do have it on our to-do to say, should we recluster and is there a better arrangement for those buses? It's not, that work is not done yet. The focus was on getting those extra buses deployed. It is on the list, I can assure you.
I appreciate
and
that.
And we'll look at it.
Because it's not a question of walking further. My people can't walk any further. They're already at the end. That's not their issue. Their issue is jockeying between the two locations. The other is more of a pure comment, again, going to the 270 series. Some of them still have to, in my opinion, some of them still have to stop at baseline. You've got people, there's a park and ride at baseline, Constellation's at baseline, Ben Franklin's at baseline, Algonquin College is at baseline. To take that out of the mix, if you're not going to supplement it with more 74s and 75s and the like to get people to baseline, then you're just shifting the congestion issue. You're not fixing the problem. So I've had this discussion with the chair as well earlier on about that. I'm not adverse to some tinkering with that, but if all the 270s suddenly don't stop at baseline anymore, they're effectively not stopping then from Tunney's all the way to Fallowfield. And there's you're going to continue to have congestion issues, continue to have crowding issues, just shifting them from one bus route to another bus route. So all I'm saying is if you're going to do that, do it with caution, because you're just potentially going to create a whole new, you're just picking up the situation, dropping it somewhere else. It's not necessarily fixing it. That's not a question, it's a comment, but baseline, as we know, is one of the busiest stations in the whole line, and there are lots of attractions there, if you follow me, for people. And we also have them up there for people in the Manordale and in the Craig Henry area. We want to encourage people to be active transportation. You take away getting to baseline in an effective way, then you're taking away those options as well. So, again, just a comment, not a question.
All right, thank you. Councillor Meehan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess this is a natural follow-up to Councillor Eglise's concerns. The 200 series of buses, well, we're experiencing just the opposite, Councillor. We're seeing the 200 series of buses fill up before people can get on to go all the way to Fallowfield. So I think we need a permanent solution to this. And I think there has to be they have to be coordinated, I would say, Mr. Manconi, and you know that we've got to have the capacity there on those buses to get people to their final destination, not have them packed when they try to get on them at Tunney. So I'm confident that you're going to look into that. Just a,
I just want to give you a compliment this morning. I was on the buses and the trains again this morning. It was a beautiful experience. It was without a hitch. It's just the way I dream of it happening every day. So thank you. But the problem is getting people home from Tunney's. It continues to be an issue. People are actually calling the office crying because they know they've got to go to Tunney's to get home, and the buses are not there. They're waiting on that platform for long periods of time. And I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but if you're not on Twitter, you don't see those packed platforms of people waiting in the cold. So my understanding is that we're going to have 20 more buses dealing with that, but these are the buses that are sitting at the baseball stadium right now. Is that the ones that are going to press into service when they are needed at Tunney's? I need to really understand how we're going to address this.
Okay, so again, you have 40 that you've added.
Mm-hmm.
That's service citywide on routes that had challenges. You will, if you approve the budget, you'll have 19 that get spread across the city also. The 20 that are stationed at the baseball stadium are in the event that there is a rail interruption. Rather than pulling off of existing routes, which is highly disruptive, they get deployed to bridge the rail service.
I understand that, but I need to know how many buses are going to address the capacity issue at Tunney's to get people to Barrhaven?
Specifically to Barrhaven?
Yeah.
We're getting you your individual list by ward, by councillor, by route. We've just finished that work. So it's the blend of the 40 plus the 19. So there's 59 buses citywide, which is hundreds of trips, to be dispersed throughout the city.
And can I tell people, is it imminent? Is it going to be January?
It's January. Pat, our planning team literally works 7 days a week straight for the last 3 weeks. We have all that done. It's codified. It's going to the bid board for operators to bid. It's rolling out in January. I'm getting each councillor a list by ward, by route, by trip. Okay. You'll have that, and then you'll have the opportunity to meet with staff if you have any follow-up questions on it.
So that we've got to get through December. Okay, not going to go over well, but at least there is a solution. I'd like to talk about scheduling. When I ride the buses, the biggest complaint that people have is, and we've heard it here this morning, the bus doesn't come when it's supposed to, the bus is late, and people are constantly asking, why does this happen? And I'm told it's scheduling. We have contracted out our scheduling to a company in Montreal, and the buses, I'm told, are sometimes behind schedule even before they start, because when they schedule, when a company outside the city schedules, they're not taking into account the factors that affect traffic, that affect the buses. It's traffic, it's congestion, it's all kinds of things. Has OC Transpo considered bringing the scheduling back from Montreal in-house the way it was done before, and schedule with management and the planning people, and make those routes reflect the actual run times so that the buses can get where they want to go on time, more on time than they are right now? Because if it takes longer for that route than it actually than it's actually scheduled for, we're going to be over. It's going to be late, and it's going to snowball over the course of the day. Have we considered bringing this back in-house?
Councillor, I don't know where this information is coming from, but we have not privatized our planning and scheduling function. We have, the software gets run out of a firm by Montreal, but we have a dedicated planning staff that put all the inputs into that process. It gets modeled. It's a very complex algorithm because you have interline bus routes and so forth. All those elements get factored in, including drive time, congestion time, time of day, all those factors, and there are multiple iterations of that model that gets done and assessed, and the quality assurance and the checks get done by professional in-house team that we have under our control. So we haven't privatized the planning of our schedule. And on top of all that, we take all of the operators have logs when they start those new routes. So in January, you take your new route. If you're on whatever route, 271, if you have issues on that route, so the timing isn't enough for signal changes and so forth, that runtime gets added to the schedule if it's consistently a problem. We have supervisors that review the scheduling. We have an operator committee that reviews it before we finalize and so forth. So there's a bunch of checks and balances in the process.
Is it possible then that we need to take another look at it and maybe change some of the data that's going in to better reflect what's actually going on the road?
That happens with every schedule change 4 times a year. And it literally, there's a whole team that does that. That's all they do is look at every single route, remembering that every day you move 325,000 customers, trips, and there's 8,200 trips. And I'm not minimizing at all the my bus was late or was busy and so or the bus was full and so forth, but there's a lot of successful trips that you don't hear about.
Oh, I agree with that.
And so the recovery time, the signal time, so forth. Part of the challenge is that when you do have a congested day or a snowy day, those buses are just like your car. They're stuck in traffic. So you can throw that schedule out the window. If they're stuck in snow, just like you are with your car, that bus, you can hope all you want. It's not going to get there any quicker because you want it to.
Okay. I guess I'd like to talk to you more about the scheduling if I can at another time. Maybe we'll
Absolutely.
Sit down. When it comes, going back to Tunney's again, with the 20 buses sitting at the baseball stadium, would it be possible to move perhaps 10 of them over to the Tunney side to address that busing issue now? That they'd be closer than having to, you know, use up fuel all day and sitting over there and then drive. Could we have them on this side where they'd be more convenient to hop onto the into Tunney's to pick up those Barrhaven people?
Remember, those 20 are not for regular service.
But could you not just have 10 doing the regular service and 10 address the issues of, no?
No, you need those 20 in the event that you're going to bridge the rail service if there's a problem. Now, the 20 that are there, we are dispersing them a little bit in terms of locating them across the network, but they're not for regular service, and they're only available in the morning and the afternoon peak periods.
Okay. Interlining. This is where the bus starts on one route in the morning and then is transferred to another. Is there any way that we can make that more efficient, where the buses that are interlined stay in the same area instead of having to go out of service across town and work over there? And I mean, I think it makes more sense to save fuel and would make more buses available faster.
So pre-LRT, you had the most interline system in North America. Post-LRT, a lot of that is coming off, so yes, absolutely right. Our goal is to balance interlining with buses staying in their geographical area. That increases your reliability and avoids you deadheading to another route. If you're a pure theoretical person, you can interline and optimize your system to the max, but then you get into sub-optimization. That's our whole discussion when you and I meet. I can take you through all that stuff. But with LRT, you're doing less interlining than you were in the past.
One last question. Are we considering hiring more fare inspectors? Because I'm told and from drivers and people, they continually witness people jumping on the buses. And once they're on the bus, they can go down and get on the train, and it is happening. And the bus drivers they're driving. They can enforce it. Can we consider that?
A couple of things. You have a fare audit coming that Mr. Hughes is doing. I've already spoken to him about it. I welcome it. You can hire... Many inspectors, but you've got 600-700 buses out in the road, so you know the math is straightforward as to how many you need.
But we only have 3 now, right?
No, we have more than that. I believe we have actively 6 on a shift, but we do concentrated blitzes. The key to fare enforcement is fare gates as much as possible, and we've done that on the LRT. We got the paid fare zones. We're also doing that on the BRT. We use PTIF funding to do some fare gates and fare vending machines. As you extend out to stage 3, you can possibly get rid of rear door boarding. But I also, just as a footnote, and I'm not saying that fare evasion is not occurring. It is. And I can tell you in the transit industry across North America, nobody can tell you the real number. Because a cheater is a cheater is a cheater. And whether you have fare gates there, whether you have a bus pass or a card, whatever, they're going to figure out how to get around the system. But often I hear about young people not paying. And I remind everybody, every secondary student in this town has a U-Pass. And so when you don't see them tapping while the data is being missed, we collect $33 million from the secondary institution. So we have that money in the bank. So fare evasion is a problem anywhere in the world. How you deal with it, I come from the mind of thought that having hundreds of fare inspectors is not the right answer. It's very costly and highly inefficient unless you can have one on every single bus across your system.
Okay. And I lied. One last question. So how many weeks of training are these new bus drivers going to have before they hit the roads? And are they going to be on local routes, not on, on transit, not on the, on the transit ways? So we're going to start them slower?
They get everything they're supposed to with our MTO regulatory framework. I'll get you the exact number of days you've asked, Councillor McKenney's asked, so obviously somebody's got a concern about
training. Think we all do, actually. We want skilled drivers to, at the wheels of our buses.
Councillor, I have to be very crystal clear on this. We've had people that have died in our accidents, and I can tell you we're audited by MTO. We were audited by the TSB, and every single operator that I put behind the wheel has to pass that rigorous testing. And it, I can guarantee you that there's no shortcuts on getting skilled operators out there.
I trust you. I trust you. We just want to hear it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. I think you meant post-secondary institutions at the UPass.
Correct, Mr. Mayor.
Councillor Leeper.
Thanks, Mayor. Just to come back to something that Councillor Brockington was asking about, which is the costs that are being put onto RTG. I appreciate the confidence with which you tell us that we will recover our costs from them. I'm just as certain that their lawyers are telling the board that they will never have to pay a penny, and it will all get sorted out in court at some point. But can we quantify the cost of that redundancy that we're currently running?
The R1 standby buses, I believe, we just answered an inquiry off the top. I think it's $95,000 a week is the R1 bus service, yeah, those 20 buses.
Okay. Is there a threshold that is mutually agreed upon with RTG as to when we've decided the system is fixed and we are no longer holding them responsible for that cost?
They have to meet all the requirements of the PA, which is a bunch of metrics in there in terms of service, AM and PM peak and so forth. So it's all defined.
Can you give me a bit more color on that? Is it fixing the comm systems issue, the door issues? Is it bigger than that?
It's actually, no, that's a great question. The way the PA works is we really don't care what the issue is. We're buying service. And AM and PM, they have to put out service to move the volume of customers that we have, and they have to do it consistently and reliably. So the interruptions they've had gives them penalties against that payment. And so in terms of the cash, they're not getting their October payment, they're not getting their November payment because of those failures that we've experienced during AM and PM rush hours. So the way the project agreement works is, we don't care what the issue is. I mean, we care, but it's theirs to figure out. We're paying for service and very frequent, reliable service, and they haven't met that mark. And so they get failure points on that data, and then they're not eligible for their funds.
Would I be correct in assuming that there is a high degree of agreement between ourselves and RTG that there have been those failures, that, in fact, the penalties are justified?
Well, back to your opening comment, they will always take the position no. I can tell you that we're not issuing the payments for October and November, and they're never eligible for that, by the way, down the road. It's not like they can come back. They can dispute it. There's always dispute mechanisms. But, you know, we have some of the best lawyers in the P3 industry from advising Mr. Kanellakis and myself. She has taken the strong position that you're heading down the right course and keep doing what you're doing.
So with respect to the redundancy at, sorry, $95,000 a week, when do we expect that we might agree with RTG that that is no longer required?
So I was wondering who was going to ask that question. So your question is, when does this all get fixed and when are we in that stable place?
Somebody asked each time.
I don't have that answer for you, Councillor. The root cause of the TCMS is what I'm focused on in terms of that will define the stability piece.
Okay.
And I can assure you, the city manager and I asked them exactly that yesterday. And if they had a date, they would have given us one, and they didn't. We're focused on the containment strategy, the root cause analysis, and so forth. I think the additional oversight that I'm bringing in will start to open up that window to see if there's a line of sight as to when we can possibly be more stable in some of those areas. I think the doors and so forth are easier to anticipate.
When we achieve that stability, how long... how fast can you remove the redundancy out? Because I'm worried about a big pressure in some upcoming budget.
The treasurer says it well. Your big cost, significant cost, is that redundancy piece, so that R1 piece. The rest, it's factored into the budget. That's a question that we're going to have to think through at point in time. It depends where we are. Are we midwinter? Are we in the spring? Are we sooner? I don't know. And how cautious do we want to be? I'm very cautious. I was the one that did the 3-week parallel service, which everybody was wondering why we did that. Well, now here we are. So we'll have to have that discussion, but it depends on when they get the TCMS issue resolved, and hopefully there's no other significant issue that creeps in after that.
1 month of redundancy, of running redundant service, once we've achieved stability, is not a huge cost. But when we get into 6 months of running redundancy or a year, so I'll be curious to hear how those discussions go. With respect to the R2 detour associated with Stage 2 LRT, is the current bus capacity that we're adding into the system drawing against that? And how do we intend to make sure we have enough R2 buses at Stage 2?
No, you've got an order of double-decker buses coming in for R2, okay, which get put into the fleet, and we'll optimize the fleet based on where we need it. So the R2 detours is not being rested. We need to manage that well. Got the Trillium line shut down and so forth that's coming.
So additional new buses will be sufficiently incremental to the current redundancies that we're offering to ensure
Correct.
That we can do both.
Correct.
Okay. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So now on to Stage 2 update.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So I'm going to walk through the three areas of the project just by geographical region, starting in the south. Okay, so the first, so just to break down the progress and where we are, we're going to go through some of the design side. So I just want to give an update on the Trillium Line work, on the design that's in progress, some of the changes that have been made to the system, to the system design, to bring it into compliance with the PSOS. So currently we're going through final designs on the airport station, the vehicle branding, which is with Stadler for implementation, and structural designs for essentially the rail separation over roads. There's roughly 19 structures that are being built as part of the Trillium Line, and so we're reviewing those now. We're also going through preliminary designs on a number of other elements, including the vehicles, the comm systems, and some of the stations. So I want to highlight some changes that have been made to the stations to bring them into compliance with the PSOS. So these are rough renderings that are a little bit different than what you would have seen at contract award. So we'll go on to the next one. So Upland Station, so the original rendering that was provided did not show on the top right of that picture. There's actually a fare free zone where you can walk through underneath the track to get to the other side for a future airport development. This station actually required two side platforms. The original rendering only showed a single side platform, and then we have redundant elevators. So this is the updated design. So if you compare this to the original rendering, there's significant changes. There's a staircase on the left. That's just an emergency exit, but essentially this is the updated Upland Station design that's fully compliant with the project agreement. A couple other changes. When we presented Leitrim and Bowesville, we didn't show any elevators, we didn't show any stairs, we only showed a ramp. So to bring it into compliance, this is kind of an updated partial rendering of Leitrim Station, where we have elevators on either side and a ramp, and there should be a stairwell as well to reach the platform. So that's a change that you will see if you go back to the original renderings. Bowesville Station is the same in terms of the updates. There's the ramp, which provides the redundancy, a covered ramp, the full length, as well as the elevators, which we've added to provide access to the platform. So two kind of, I would say, not insignificant changes to those two stations in order to make them more accessible to the general public. So the other big change, and this is a flexibility that the design build team had in their contract, is it was up really up to them to choose whether they wanted to do an at-grade station, essentially, you know, having to grade separate line bank over the rail, or if they wanted to do the reverse. At the time of their presentation, they were planning to do line bank over the rail. They've since adjusted that design. So this is now an elevated line bank station. So the rail will run over line bank road. We're still working through the connectivity issues down at grade level, but otherwise this is the design that they're moving forward with. So all of these changes have now been implemented or incorporated into their designs. This is, you know, there are no costs associated with these changes. These are all just to bring them into compliance with our requirements. In terms of the construction, so the construction, you will see, I'll show you in a minute a lot of the photos of the work. Still kind of targeting the section to the south where we're doing active work. The one change is they have gone in a little bit early into New Walkley Yard, and I'll show you that in a second. So essentially all of the areas of the south are under construction, and then the area to the north will start under construction as of May of next year. So I'll just show you a quick video which kind of has a highlight of the work that's ongoing on the system now. So I'll show you some brief construction photos of the work that's going on in Walkley Yard. On this photo, you can see in the distance, just to give you a sense of scale, there is a construction worker kind of in the distance. So they are rebuilding Walkley Yard. That's an active rail yard at the moment, so they're having to work around the existing Trillium Line service that launches out of the existing Walkley Yard from every day. The foundations are going in place for the new building. Essentially, there's going to be a new building in place to handle all of the maintenance activity, car wash, wheel lathe, everything that you need to maintain a fleet. So here's kind of a bird's eye view of Walkley Yard. You see the CN yard there on the right, which is an active rail yard still. We're still doing deliveries down to the NRC facility just south of Leicester Yard. You see in the middle of the photo, there's a new track there. That's a new track that's been put in place to allow vehicles from the Trillium Line to get into service while they build the new Walkley Yard. A little bit just about the airport link. So you see a lot of activity on the airport parkway in terms of a litmus test for tracking progress. It's really the progress of all the grade separations on the line. You'll see structures go up over the airport parkway, allowing space for future widening of the parkway. You'll see a structure going up over Uplands. You'll see the structures going up over Leitrim, Leicester. And basically, every single road crossing, that's how we're going to track, essentially, from a high level, how they're making progress. This is a view, so that on the bottom is that actually an active rail link that we still use to do deliveries to the NRC facility, so that needs to be maintained throughout the construction period. And then you see this is essentially the spur that goes off for the airport link that goes off to the airport terminal. You won't see it. A lot of it's hidden away from the road traffic, but they're essentially doing a rail grade separation over the airport parkway, then an embankment up to Upland Station, and then from there, again, a rail separation over Uplands Road to get to the airport. A lot of caisson activity, a lot of basic construction that's happening at the moment. You'll see a lot of essentially big equipment at those locations building up the caissons and putting the foundations in place to build those grade separations. Just, you know, the constructor here just painted one of their caisson drilling units pink in celebration or in recognition of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So that's been out on the Airport Parkway for a number of months now. And then we're just going to, just some quick highlights, some photos that we'll skip through of the caisson drilling activity, and then I'll show you a quick time-lapse video. So essentially they're coring down a foundation right to bedrock, so it's going roughly 30 meters down to get to bedrock to set the foundation for the elevated structures. So this is the video. If you look at the screen on the left, this is just a time lapse of once they've drilled out the essentially into the bedrock, they're doing a they're going to lift a essentially structural steel that they're going to drop down into the hole, and then they'll go in and they'll fill it in afterwards to create that foundation. So you get a sense of the, you know, the scale of the work here. You know, it's a big construction activity that they're doing to do all these grade separations. So there's roughly 74 of these caissons that need to be installed on the Trillium Line in order to handle all the grade separations. So after they drill out the caisson, they put in the rebar, they fill it up with concrete, then there's some testing that they do just to verify the structural integrity. That's essentially, you know, them building from the ground up to make those grade separations. A couple of quick shots here just, you know, as they build up the foundation for the grade separation. A couple of shots here just of the guideway that's being built. The next one, Limebank Station, essentially the link from Bowesville out to Limebank. That's the foundation for the track that's going to be laid, likely starting next year. And then as you saw in the video, and we've tweeted this out previously, all the rail has been delivered for the Trillium Line. They're going to set up a welding shop at that location to be able to kind of manage the quality control for all the welds, and then the rail will be moved along the alignment to be installed in at the various locations where we're adding rail or we're creating new rail. So just some upcoming activities for the Trillium Line. So continued tree clearing. There's going to be a lot of activity on the existing line. Commencement of the airport link guideway construction. Walkley maintenance facility is going to go forward. That'll start to come out of the ground next year. Essentially, all of the grade separations will start to go in place in the southern extension. That's essentially a simple way to kind of track the progress of the project. The other kind of key indicator for the project that we're tracking is the delivery of the rail vehicles coming from Switzerland, which should start to arrive in middle of 2021, late 2021. So that's the Trillium Line. So I'll go through a little bit of work that's happening on the east extension. So just in terms of the construction drawings, so this is really where the design is finished and they're progressing to field works. You know, Montreal Road overpass, you know, the crux of the project in the east in order to get the connection out to all the way out to Trim Road, and then final designs on roadway drainage, utilities, and the Greens Creek culvert. So there's a number of kind of key things that they need to get started on next year, and so these are the ones that the design is essentially complete or it's in its final stages of completion. Some of the preliminary designs that we're still working through with them at the moment, John Dark Station, Place d'Orléans Station, Trim Station, still taking a look at the connectivity to those stations. There is kind of some preliminary plans, but we're trying to kind of make sure we take a holistic view on how we get to all of those stations. Orléans Station is not on the list, but it will be next in terms of their construction packages. Going through all of that work now to make sure that we're ready for construction. The schedule, so you've seen a lot of activity out in the east, especially around the Montreal Road. There's a big setup there in terms of a staging area for the work. If we go to the next slide, you see some of the kind of preparatory work. There's a couple of major water mains that are being replaced. There's the Highway 174 and Montreal Road interchange widening, which is really the crux of the project in the east. We'll go quickly to the next. This is a description of the work. Essentially, we're widening the Highway 174 to make space for the station in the middle of the highway. If you go to the next slide, you'll see just the configuration. It's a little bit difficult to see, but essentially yellow is where the roads are now, and green is where we're going to. So still maintaining, you know, the two lanes in each direction plus a lane for the transit. So the three lanes are essentially being moved out of the way so that we can build an elevated station above Montreal Road at that location. So there's going to be a lot of activity, a lot of shifting of lanes, a lot of widening of lanes to essentially make space for the LRT station and the LRT running down the middle of the 174. So you'll start to see some of that work, you know, pretty quickly here. You know, they need to do some foundation work. They need to put in some shoring to be able to move that the highway lanes over to make space, and then there's a couple of water main replacements that run under the 174, so that work is bundled in with this project. So that's a quick rundown of the work in the east and the west. In terms of the construction drawings, so this is really where they're ready to start work. I think everyone's seen the work on the Sir John A. Macdonald Parkway. They've already done a shift. Essentially, we're trying to get the entire SJAM out of the way so we can build the cut and cover tunnel. So that's kind of a primary activity that's happening now. There's a number of, here it's called a pedestrian overpass. It's really the car overpass over the pedestrian underpass. So the structures that allow you to get from, you know, essentially across the Sir John A. Macdonald Parkway to the NCC land. So all of that design is underway now. In terms of final designs, we're still Goldenrod Bridge. It's a new one just at the far side of Tunney's, which will allow for a traffic reconfiguration in that area. A couple more pedestrian underpasses that get you over to the NCC lands. And then Lincoln Fields, there's an elevated structure there, which is going to be a complex structure to build. We're in final design on that. Preliminary designs, essentially stations across the alignment in the west. Also looking at the maintenance facility that we put in at Moody. A number of the ramp designs, working closely with the MTO to make sure they're satisfied with the ramp designs and the configuration of how we get, you know, how we change that to make space for the LRT. Construction schedule, no change here in terms of what we've previously communicated. Still looking at next year to start the cut and cover tunnel. That work starts right away. And then we have activities ongoing throughout the alignment in the other locations to get ready. The last kind of segment to be started is that little bit between Tunney's and Dominion. And we're holding that off till the end to kind of push that out in the schedule as long as possible to minimize the amount of time that we have that section on detour. So a lot of tree clearing. I know there's been a lot of discussions and questions about this, so we did want to touch on this briefly. They're roughly 70% done, I believe, across the alignment, East-West Connectors, who's doing the work is. You know, there's still some work that's left to be done to make space. Sir John A. Macdonald Parkway, there's still a little bit more work to be done there. Lincoln Field, still a little bit more work. So we're doing that really just to make space for the LRT. The next photo shows the tree clearing at Iris, obviously making space for the station. And I just want to talk a little bit about the tree mitigation strategy because we're doing a bit of a different strategy between the two projects. On the Trillium Line project where we had to create space for the airport link, there's not actually space to replant trees. And so in order to compensate for the tree removals, we're doing a transfer of funds to the city's forestry department so that they can essentially reallocate the replacement throughout the city. For the Confederation Line, there is space. Trees are replaced at a 2-to-1 ratio. The species and nature, there's been questions about that from a number of councillors, are really part of the landscape package design where East-West Connectors has to come back and demonstrate to us where they're putting trees, what's the species of the trees, the quantity, the size of the trees. Essentially, at a 2-to-1 ratio is the simple math, but you know, when we take out a larger tree, the ratios can be higher. So just a little bit of a close-up on the construction of the tunnel. So there are two new tunnels being put in place. The big one, obviously, the 2.5 kilometers through the SJAM. So if we go to the next slide, you can see a little bit of the yellow is essentially the end state for the parkway. So the parkway is changing. Its end state is being pushed further away from the shoreline a little bit. So it's a temporary condition where we push over the SJAM towards the river to make space for the cut and cover tunnel. And then once the tunnel's essentially finished, then we can do the final work to reinstate that final kind of circuitous path for the SJAM in that area. So straight line shot for the tunnel, but a bit of a, you know, a wavy line, yellow line there that you see for the final end state for the SJAM. So the first, the westbound shift has been completed. You know, we're starting to do construction to enable another eastbound shift in the spring 2020. That will enable us to get the SGM out of the way entirely to start construction on the tunnel. Quick photo of some of the work. You would have seen the shift happened about a week ago in this area for the westbound, and so we're getting ready to do a shift in the eastbound in the spring. Some upcoming activities for the Confederation Line. So Byron Linear Park, there's a major hydropole and Bell Line relocation that needs to take place. A number of utility relocations. Iris Culvert, you know, as part of that entire area being reworked, and the pond restoration and the stream work, you know, there's a culvert that needs to be moved there. So a lot of activity happening in around Iris to kind of essentially prepare for the future work that has to happen. So that essentially covers the, you know, the Trillium Line, the Confederation Line, east and west. But the other kind of moving part in all of this is the Stage 2 order of vehicles. So we just wanted to give you an update on where we are with that. So there is an additional 38 vehicles that are being built, you know, a split of assembly at this point being done, some in Ottawa and some moving to the Brampton facilities. The next challenge for us is really to test those vehicles and put miles on them in order to get them into service. So the next slide gives you a bit of an overview of how we plan to do that. Well, here's, we do a number of tests at night during engineering hours when it's out of service. We need Alstom to safety certify the vehicle. We also need the signaling supplier to safety certify the vehicle. Once we have those two things in hand, really the next step is for us to have the comfort to make them available for regular use. And so in order to do that, we are working with RTG to establish kind of a minimum number of kilometers that we want to see on those vehicles before we put passengers on them, before we use them as part of normal service. Obviously, we don't want to finish them, put them into service, and have immediate service issues with those new vehicles. So we are planning, once we have the safety certification on those vehicles from RTG, we are planning on running vehicles in this, roughly in this configuration, in out of service hours, clearly marked during service hours, late though, off peak, mixed in with regular traffic to get additional kilometers on these vehicles to essentially prove them out to make sure that they're reliable for service. So the next slide essentially shows you the status of where we are. So 24 vehicles awaiting production, 8 vehicles in production, 6 vehicles are undergoing the testing. So that's the Alstom testing for safety certification, that's the Thales testing, and then essentially what we're going to call a burn-in or acceptance testing, where we want to see a minimum number of kilometers on those vehicles without failures before we put them into service. Or if there are failures, that we know that we've rectified them and they won't occur again. So that's those last 6 that are undergoing testing, we want to introduce those into the fleet to add essentially to the spare count for the Stage 1 vehicles so that we can go to that 14th and 15th train in service. And then just kind of a summary of some of the outreach that we're doing. We have a number of sessions set up this month where we're going out to the community to, you know, provide an update on the work that we're doing, the construction works, the end state with the LRT system. You know, we obviously, these sessions are focused on areas where there's specific construction, but if there's a desire for broader sessions just on the overall Stage 2 project in any part of the community, we're happy to accommodate. We've got a team working on this, and they're eager to get out and spread the word about the project. So, you know, if there's any kind of questions or any requests for additional sessions, we're happy to accommodate those. And that's the quick update on the Stage 2 construction.
Thank you. Just on the dates when the Trillium Line will be shut down, how long will that take? And I know it's going to be quite a inconvenience, particularly for people at Carleton and so on, because that's the main corridor. Is there any way that the portion that's existing now can open sooner than the whole system, or what's the rationale for keeping it all closed until everything's ready?
There's a number, so the shutdown right now is the first week of May 2020, when the Trillium Line will be have to go to the R2 service. The additional buses that John mentioned are being added you know, and there's a number of changes we're making, including Raven Road, to kind of help improve that service. The rationale for the length of the shutdown is, in part, it starts with MTO is replacing the highway bridge over the Trillium Line. They're starting that work in May. That will run at least until November. So they need to replace that bridge, which is over the tracks. The other thing that we're doing, which is adding a lot of time to the project, is a grade separation over the VIA diamond. So the Trillium Line does interface with the VIA service. VIA is looking at expanding. They're adding more trains all the time. And so to the extent that we can separate those two lines, that will help us. That's a big portion of the project. And then there's just other elements such as rock, you know, the rock cut in the north where we're adding more double tracking, you know, we just need to shut the system down to do that. So to the extent that we could shorten up the schedule, we're always looking for opportunities to do that. But at this point, with those kind of two major projects, it will be difficult to shorten it or to keep that section of the line in service.
Right. Okay, Councillor Meehan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have to say it's really exciting to see this. I've been trying to show people in the east part of Ward 22 some of the progress, but so I thank you for the video. Wasn't able to shoot all of it, but thank you very much. My question, Mr. Morgan, is now that we know some of the problems in the design of the Confederation Line, what are we going to do to make sure that we don't repeat that? We want to have platforms that are large enough for folks. We want to have enclosures so people don't have to be out in the elements. What are we doing in order to address these issues?
You know, we're paying attention to everything that's happening on stage one with the stations to understand, you know, is there a better way to configure the platforms? Is there a different approach with the trains? You know, we're taking all of that information in to see, you know, how we can, you know, if there's an opportunity to adjust or if there's an opportunity to improve, enhance the design for stage two.
We think that we know that we can do much better. So at what point are we going to sit down and actually look at the design and say, this has got to be different and let's work on it now?
I think we're doing that now. I think that some of the changes that that you've seen with the stations already are a result of, you know, the changes that we made to the PA a couple of years ago and enforcing those changes now. You know, if there's specific things that we want to look at in relation to the station designs, we're happy to take that feedback. We're getting that feedback all the time from councillors and from staff and working with transit to look at, you know, what opportunities there are to improve the overall design.
It's going to cost some money. Is that going to prohibit some of the changes that we might expect?
I think we're looking at, you know, where are the opportunities, the easy wins, I would say, to improve the service. At this point, we're not going to enclose stations. We're not putting roof structures on everything. That would be cost prohibitive at this point.
We're always seeing the problems that's causing right now. And a lot of these stations are really out in the open. Don't you think that this is a priority now? This is Canada.
Mr. Mayor, just a couple of things. The council raises some very valid things, and I can assure you there's a long list of lessons learned from stage one. We actually did a review of all those things. Michael reports directly to me, so it's all one department, and there's interfaces on that. But a couple of things. Stage one was your most difficult part of your project. Why? Because you have two terminus stations that are temporary in nature, so the Tunneys and Blair situation with the high volumes and so forth. That all changes with the extensions of stage two. The southern part is totally different than what you're seeing in terms of the east-west volumes and so forth. I think some of the challenges that are before you, and this is a council issue, is this expectation of enclosing stations, for example. That's hundreds of millions of dollars and is not done anywhere. This is not a subway system. These are at-grade stations, and to enclose them and heat them and so forth, that ship sailed 9 years ago, when you made the decision to go with this type of system. So if you go to Calgary, if you go to Baltimore, if you go to Boston and so forth, where they have similar climates, they don't have enclosures in there. Those stations are open air like yours. The lessons learned on both the small things that are important to the customer and the bigger things that are important to the customer, I can assure you there's a list of that gets managed. There is a contingency fund that we can tap into that if we need to. But in terms of big wholesale design changes, there's no room for that. You're locked into your design that you've approved and to those things and to the macro standards that drive the service.
What about protection of some sort? I mean, we're putting up scaffolding at Tunney's to try to protect people standing there. I mean, why don't we just do it proactively?
You are. I think the station renderings that you've seen, you've got that. All those stations will have that protection. You will not have the scope and scale of transfer stations that you have at Tunney's and Blair. Herdman is an end station transfer point, and that one, with the exception of a wider sidewalk, you're not hearing the similar complaints because it was designed for end state. Tunney's and Blair, I know it's difficult, temporary stations. There was no money in your budget to enclose those stations. I heard a resident tell me to build a bridge from one end of the platform to the other so they don't have to walk around and so forth. That was never your design. You were capped at $2.1 billion, and staff did the best they could. And I can assure you, I know we're going to get complaints about the scaffolding. I've already heard it. Is that the best you can do in the nation's capital? We're doing the best we can with what we've got. But you don't have those macro issues on stage two. You built the toughest part. You put the busiest BRT in North America underground with no at-grade crossings. This is the tough part. Stage two gets much, much easier. And the southern extension to your ward, Councillor, it's a complicated project, but it has a lot of the benefits of a modern railroad and great stations also, and an airport link.
Are we going to be looking at beefed up transit, like buses in the outside along this transit, the trains, the train line, because we need to get people there to the stations?
You'll have great feeder systems to those stations. You've invested in the park and ride lots. Mm-hmm. And once you get on that train at the southern end of it, remember, you'll beat traffic, all traffic, car or bus, to get to downtown any day, whether it's good weather or bad weather. That's been proven on the timeline.
I just want to make sure that you know just how excited we are by seeing the progress and knowing that this is coming out there. But is there an opportunity for the communities? I know we're going to do overviews with people to get their input and what they think is going to be necessary in these stations as, you know, along the way.
I mean, we're going to run those consultations. We'll take the feedback where we can. Happy to, make adjustments where they're simple and where it's there's an easy win there for customers. The big changes are difficult at this point in time, but I think there's lots of room to make small changes and small adjustments to the stations and to the trains, and so we're open to that feedback.
So that's like stairs, the tiles, things like that, the size of the platform, those types of things, trains with straps, everything. That's what we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And can we sit down, Mr. Morgan, and take a look at the small changes that we have looked at so far?
Absolutely.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor. Councillor Tierney, please.
Great. Thank you very much. And I certainly see a lot of excitement in our communities, especially in the East. You actually see a lot of the progress. Also, from a consultative point of view and making sure people know, I'm always shocked how many people don't realize the train is going down the middle of the highway in the future. So the tools that are required for us East End councillors, I'll be putting out a lot of pieces in the beginning of the year. And you guys are doing a great job. I guess on the 5th, we have our East End line meeting, which I'm very excited about. But in some of the illustrations that have come out, the 3D illustrations, which are purely conceptual, just to show the stations. I took one of Montreal Road Station underneath, and I used that, and I showed the fading of what it is today versus what it will be in the future. And unfortunately, there's a rollerblader on the sidewalk, and everyone on Twitter reminded me, wow, that's dangerous. Our final illustration is going to be a little more realistic, and I'm asking that kind of tongue-in-cheek because there is actually a cycling lane in a very awkward position on the illustration for Montreal Road. At what point do the cycling community, a pedestrian community, they all get involved to help finalize that design, especially under the overpasses?
So the station renderings through the design process, which we're going through now, will be updated to the final design. That's the requirement under the PA. So you will be able to see better renderings at that time. In terms of the connectivity, all of those reviews are happening now, and so to the extent that we can get your feedback now, now is the appropriate time for that.
Okay, so on that, so ballpark, and I won't hold you to a firm date, but is it, you're talking, it's imminent, like the next month, 6 months for these final illustrations, just because I don't want to make the investment to do any kind of physical mailings or any kind of distribution and have the wrong imagery in it.
Yeah, I could get you a schedule for when we expect the final renderings to be done, but I expect it would probably be sometime middle of next year for the earlier stations where the final design is complete. But I'll get you the schedule so you know exactly.
Okay, so just for when I'm informing my neighborhood now, I'll put, you know, this is for design purposes only, not the final renderings,
correct,
et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I also had a question around, now people are starting to realize, yeah, you're not going to get on a bus in the neighborhood and go all the way back to Blair. Montreal Road will be your future home for a hub. What point are we going to start really engaging our communities about those new routes and what they could look like?
The team's going to come and talk to you about what those new routes look like, and we're superimposing that onto your stage one setup that we've done. So I don't have the exact timeline on that, but I can assure you that, again, everyone that is affected by any of those changes, we're going to meet with you one-on-one. And then you can talk to us if you want to do a ward meeting.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Councillor Tierney. Councillor Brockington, please.
Thank you, Your Worship. And just to go back to some station design challenges that we've seen once phase one opened. Is there actually, though, time to make changes to the design? I know some changes are more expensive than others, but where are we on the timelines of actual design sign-off?
Some of the stations are near completion in terms of their design. To the extent that we get, you know, we can always make changes right till the end. They cost more at the end, you know. So if we get your feedback now, we can get those in and try to get them in at no cost, depending on the nature of the changes.
So I didn't see any updates today on Walkley Station in South Keys. Where are they right now as far as design goes?
Yeah, I don't think we've seen the preliminary designs for those just yet. They've been focused on some of the stations in the south, largely because that's where they can start work right away. And then I can review with the team the status of those for your information. Those station designs haven't changed a lot, and so today part of the renderings that I was bringing forward were really to highlight the changes, the significant changes that have been made since you would have seen the renderings at contract award. So I wanted to make sure you were aware of those changes. Walkley and Gladstone and those other stations, Bayview, I'm happy to go and find out the timing for when you'll see those final designs so you can inform, you know, make have an opportunity to provide some feedback.
I would like to request that we sit down to specifically look at Walkley and South Keys stations. Those are the main stations my residents will be using, particularly the design inside and out. I guess, you know, at the end of the day, I could be arm twisted to agree with stations that are open aired as long as people are safe. And the one issue that I've raised repeatedly is at Herdman Station, where that north side of the station for people who arrive and are transferring to come downtown, it's all open. And my concern is, as we get freezing rain, snow, all types of weather events, that may impact people's ability to climb safely up and down those stairs. That's what I'm worried about. So I'm not as worried about it being cold as I am people being impacted by weather and getting inside our stations. Just like when I see some of our fare boxes out in the open, I think Tunney's has some facing Scott Street. I'm not sure that's good. I want people to be covered and at least comfortable when they're buying tickets. And I'm also concerned about the impacts on the machines over time from just weather. I do like what I see. I mean, I travel the Airport Parkway. Walkley Yard is in my ward, and there is definitely progress. It generates a lot of discussion in the community, and it's good to see that. So appreciate the update in that regard. The EY Center, just the name Uplands, is that a holding name for the station? Are we actually going to have some sort of public opportunity to name that station, or what is it going to be called?
I don't recall where we are on that process. We had a naming process for stage one. Councillor, can I get back to you?
Yes, of course.
To check with staff. I know we've talked about it. I just lost track of where
thank
we are
you,
with that.
Thank you. And again, just to confirm, I mean, huge benefit to the EY Center to have a station built on their property, shuttling convention attendees and others, not having to pay for parking. Obviously, I support this, but again, to confirm, there's no financial contribution, unlike the Airport Authority, which is chipping in millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars for their station, no financial contribution being made by the EY Center for this station. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's no different than New Ottawa.
Okay. The mayor touched upon this, the Trillium line shutdown. We've had many conversations about the length of time and the reasons, all the work that's going on. The road modifications servicing Carleton University, I've noticed a new road built at the northern end of their parking lot that now abuts Bronson Avenue. Was not aware of this road. I thought the discussions about a bus-only entrance and exit was going to be at the south side of, I think it's called Raven Field, sort of the practice field. Is that still in the works, and is this road Carleton University led, unrelated to OC Transpo?
Correct. Raven Road, it's a new Raven Road that's being essentially creating a new access point, buses only, that's being added next year.
But that would be at the far south end
Correct.
Of the property. Okay. All right. Obviously, a number of R2 buses will be put on the system to provide service during the shutdown. Will you be complementing or providing additional service on other bus routes? Folks don't want to take the replacement bus. Maybe they want to go from downtown to Herdman and get on the 97 or the 98 to get them to the south end. Are you going to be providing service as well? You can't assume that everyone's going to want to take the replacement bus. It's not as convenient, I think, if you're going from Greenboro to Bayview and vice versa. Are we putting only additional resources on the replacement service, or are some of the other routes going to get additional resources as well?
Councillor, I'll get you that from Pat and his team. I know the theme is not to make it I know we call it R2, but we want it to be a good bus route with a lot of access points and good continuity and good connection. So Pat's got those details. I'll do that as a follow-up if I can with you.
If the new Civic Hospital welcomes a station, a Trillium Line station, on their property on the south side of Carling, that could take quite a while to build, and I'm quite concerned about another shutdown of the Trillium Line after 2+ years that we're just about going into in May. Where are you on your discussions with the Civic, and have you considered avoiding another lengthy shutdown of the line if this station was going to be built?
Yes, Councillor, great question. We actually met with them last spring, a whole integrated team, and talked exactly about the future and what it holds, although they're years away from actually breaking ground. That was exactly our point, is they know our schedule. They know that we are encouraging them to connect and orient all those facilities so that there's great connectivity there. And we gave them some outside-the-box thinking about how they can leverage the Carling station and not have to build another station and so forth. So great discussions with the hospital team, and we're connected with them.
Very good. Very supportive of that possibility. But again, the impact on the riders needs to be considered. My last question, time is running out. Can we get ourselves to a point, once Phase 2 opens, that we will eventually have a seamless ability to travel from the airport to Bayview Station without transferring at South Keys? Can we get ourselves lined up to ensure that if I'm going downtown, I'm not going to have to take 3 rides, then eventually can go from airport to Bayview and then transfer onto the Confed line?
So the rail infrastructure is being built to allow that, to allow a through train essentially from the airport to Bayview. So that will be in place. At that point, it really becomes a service planning decision about ridership and trying to balance the ridership coming from the south, coming from Line Bank area, with the ridership coming from the airport.
Okay. We'll talk more. This has to be a priority for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Leeper.
Thanks, Mayor. Really quickly, first, I think I heard you say this in September, but I just want to make sure the rail damping to deal with the noise issue in Hintonburg and Mechanicsville is relatively imminent now. That same rail damping is being done proactively where the same rail conditions exist in the trench, concrete plinth with the rock walls. You're going to put that rail damping in there as well?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. And just curious, will the trains that are now in production and some being tested, will they have more or fewer kilometers of testing than the first batch by the time they go into service?
They will have fewer than the first batch. The okay. first batch we used for, you know, a period of years for driver training, for test and commissioning of a large number of systems. So there was no minimum requirement on the original 34. But as the project kind of ran long and we, you know, used them for additional purposes, they actually, a number of them, you know, got quite a few kilometers on them.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Councillor Leeper. Councillor Blay, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Yesterday, the Orleans councillors were on a conference call about economic development in around Stage 2 stations, and it was indicated to us that station design is approaching completion, or modifications are approaching completion. But I don't think any of us have seen any of that yet, so I'm just wondering when we might go over some of the changes to the station design, because as you know, there are some changes we would like to see.
I think that the primary discussion that we've had is around the connectivity changes, and so we're scheduled to do an internal review early next week, and then at that point we would bring forward some ideas for consideration, especially for some of the East End stations in terms of potential changes.
Okay, so should we expect to get an update from you on the changes to the stations or the connectivity by the end of the year?
We're aiming to get you something by the end of the year, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Right, that's it, Councillor. Thank you. Councillor Dudas, please.
Okay. Great, thank you. So I was curious, I know a lot of my colleagues have been asking about station design. I concur with that, and I won't ask the same question. I do specifically want to ask about Montreal Road Station, however. You had mentioned that there are plans to provide connectivity to the various stations, and that work is underway. When can we expect to see connectivity to that station and other stations across the board?
So we're doing it, going through all of the stations, kind of revisiting the original design to understand where there's opportunities for improvement. And as I just mentioned, we're looking to get the East End stations completed by the end of this year, or at least Montreal Road might be the one exception, but the other ones, certainly Orleans, Place d'Orleans, Jeanne d'Arc, we have that information. We've been working on it with the planning team closely. We have some internal reviews in the next couple of weeks and hoping to get you some ideas before the end of the year.
Are you taking public feedback on those connectivity options?
You know, as part of the outreach to the community, where, you know, we'll be bringing forward some of the ideas once we've had a chance to essentially brief staff and brief yourselves. We want to get your feedback first and then take it out to the public at that point.
So in respect to the connectivity, but also the station designs, I'm hearing, you know, the word final said, I'm hearing, you know, I just want to stress, and I don't think any of us can stress enough, that you know, we are learning lessons just as much as you are in respect to stage one, and our input and the input from our public through us is vital before it gets to be final. So, I mean, in terms of terminology, I don't like that word. I like to think that we still have some play on it, even if it is minor, but it's very important we get this right. The other thing I wanted to ask in respect to Montreal Road Station, you have advised us, and I appreciate that, in respect to the impacts on the highway and the detouring and the rerouting in that respect. What can we expect in terms of if there's any detours or impacts on the cycling infrastructure, the pedestrian infrastructure, and even the road infrastructure underneath the bridge during the construction?
So As part of stage two, you know, one of the changes that was made in stage one, the mobility matters regime, essentially a lane rental regime, only considered car traffic and bus traffic. It didn't consider pedestrians. It didn't consider cyclists. And so in stage two, the mobility matters program now considers those additional kind of lenses and has a requirement in place for the builder to essentially maintain access. There's new provisions in there for the duration of the, you know, if there's a, for example, a cycling detour or a pedestrian detour, if it's in place for a given amount of time, then they have to pave it. They can't just leave it as stone dust if they want to keep it that way I think the prescribed time is 7 days. So there's a number of changes there, that a number of obligations that we passed on to the design builder to ensure that they maintain access at all times. Where there is a detour or a change that's coming, we will try to let you know well in advance so that you have an opportunity to review it and give your feedback on that plan.
And I just wanted to once more about that particular station. I noticed in your presentation that, you know, there are a number of the East End stations are in final or right, close to final. When do we, I know Councillor Tierney asked this, but when do we get to see Montreal Road Station? Because construction starts on that first, so...
The big lift on Montreal Road, which is starting first, is really the creating an elevated structure. So a lot of it's at this stage of the project, it's a structural design to kind of move, to shift the highway over, make essentially two new highway bridges, and then create an intermediate structure that will house the station. So that portion of the work is very advanced, because they want to start that as soon as possible. The fit up of the station, the specific details around the footprint and the heating, those things are kind of all up for discussion at this point in time. Councillor Tierney was asking about the specific renderings for the station. So those typically come with the final design. But if there's features of the stations that you want to discuss, or the connectivity of the station that you want to discuss, now is the time to do that.
Well, I'm thinking specifically about the detours, because that's coming fast and furious right, with this particular station. So the faster you can get it out to us, the faster we can share it, the better off we are.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Councillor Dudas. Councillor Cavanaugh, please.
Thank you very much. We're all excited about Stage 2. There's no doubt about it, but lots of questions to ask about it. One of the questions that was asked to me by residents, and you're going to get more of these questions tonight, because we're going to have the open house for the Cleary-Lincoln Field section, and certainly I expect a good turnout. What do you define as a tree? Because you're talking about the ratio being 2-to-1, but I haven't heard a definition of what you're counting as the tree that would be for the 2-to-1.
The tree has to be a certain size for it to count. So there's a width, and they do a survey of the trees. I can get you the specific details on the replacement and on the measurement for your area, if you like.
That would be very helpful, because that question's going to come up tonight. So people want to know what you're talking about. And I appreciate the fact that you've mentioned that some of the larger trees are going to get even a higher ratio, because there's certainly a lot of sensitivity around the fact that over 100-year-old trees had to be taken down. So I appreciate that they're getting a higher ratio than 2-to-1. In terms of the differences of what we're seeing in stage one to stage two, what would be some of the main differences in the trains that you're ordering? Are they going to have different doors, for example?
We're ordering 38 additional trains, the same train for the Confederation Line. The difference is we have the benefit of experience from the Stage 1 trains, and any of the modifications or updates that have been made will be applied to the Stage 2 vehicles.
Okay, that's very helpful. And I just want to comment that... Councillor Brockington already asked questions about the airport connectivity and connection, so I look forward to more information on that. In terms of connectivity, that's probably one of the biggest questions I have still. There's still some unanswered areas in terms of how to get to the stations, particularly Lincoln Fields, where it's not totally clear about the access, and we have a major development happening next door to it at Lincoln Fields property, formerly the mall, which will no longer be a mall. And that's considered transit-oriented development, and yet the connection is rather poor between that that site and the station, because the parkway exit is between that. And so we've got an off-ramp there that comes from the SJAM, which means people have to walk across basically just an area where people slow down to yield and get onto Carling. It's not great. In other places, there's bridge connections, and there's where pedestrian safety is put at a priority. And I wonder, are you open to working on improving these connections to attract more ridership? Because there's certainly been a lot of concerns raised about this, particularly people who live in the on the northwest side of the station, in terms of trying to get to the station. I know there have been some negotiations with NCC about this, but there's still a lot of concerns because some of the traditional routes that they had been taking before, such as cutting through properties where there was a hole in the fence and things like that to get to the station currently, are just totally unacceptable.
In a number of places, we've worked with the development community closely. Algonquin College is contributing to a pedestrian overpass. Trinity's contributing to a pedestrian overpass. In other areas, there was a natural need for one, and so that's being included in the project. But absolutely, we're with you to look at all options to make sure people can get to those stations.
Okay, so you're still open to some connectivity to that property? Because I'm hearing loud and clear that that is a big concern with people. And it's not just about the property. It's about people just getting from the northwest side to get to Lincoln Fields. And keep in mind that that area will not ever be part of the LRT route. These are people that will always be walking towards the LRT station there. So I appreciate it. Also at Queensview Station, when can we see the connectivity there? Because we still do not have a route that is confirmed.
I'll have to confirm with the team on that one.
Okay, because it's been a long time coming. We've already voted for a budget back in March, and so we'll have to be expropriating property that won't be under that envelope of the funding, which is problematic. So I know it's a pressure on the city, but we do have to decide where there's a route at that Queensview station. It's a very important station, and I hope to see some information on that. Anyway, I look forward to our meeting tonight, and thank you.
Thank you, Councillor. Councillor McKenney, please.
Thank you. I just want to go back to the Trillium line. I wonder why the north part of the Trillium line is not going to be kept open as you build the south side. I guess I'm worried about the Trillium line. I like the Trillium line. It works really well, and it carries, I think, about 19,000 people a day. So that, we're going to have buses going through the neighborhoods. And so two questions, I guess. One is, why we can't maintain that northern part of the line, and what happens if stage two is late? Like, do you have any worry about the Trillium line being shut down for more than the planned 18 months?
So, that northern section there, there's the two big projects that I spoke about, the 417 replacement over the rail line. That's, a major activity to replace that structure. Underneath that structure, we're doing rock cut excavation. There's a long section essentially between the future Gladstone station to south of the 417. That entire section, I don't know the methodology just yet, but we need to get in there and make space for double tracking. So that's very intrusive work. The work above with the 417 is very intrusive. The grade separation at VIA, it's essentially a large structure that has to go up and over the VIA, up and over the transitway, up and over the creek that's at that location. So it's not a simple grade separation. A few of the other grade separations to the south over Leitrim, over Leicester, they're pretty straightforward. You can drop in single span structures. The structure over VIA, knowing that VIA is running their service is complicated. So to keep the northern portion running essentially would push the schedule out for the project, you know, by years. So that's kind of the difficulty there. In terms of tracking the project schedule, you know, I mentioned a few kind of key indicators that we're following. One is wanting to see those structures go up in the south very quickly, wanting to track the progress on the structures in the north, wanting to see that the vehicles arrive on schedule. So we'll have an early heads up to know if there's any issues in that sense.
So it's a $1.6 billion contract. Of that $1.6 billion, how much of that is for the maintenance, and what are those maintenance pieces?
So the 1.6, so the capital construction contract is roughly $700, and then the remainder is all payback during the maintenance period.
So it's only $700 million to build the Stage 2 Trillium line? That doesn't seem to be enough money. I mean, I don't know anything about building. It just seems like not very much money to build that line.
So $700 million plus plus the vehicle contract, so $810 million for that construction contract.
Hmm. And then the remainder is for?
The remainder is the 27 years of maintenance payments.
Payments.
If you kind of sum those up to get to the $1.6
billion. Okay. And you're confident that this can all be built for $700 million? You have that confidence?
I've got a fixed price contract, yes.
Yeah, but we've seen what's happened with fixed. I mean, that's not my question. I get that we have a fixed price contract, but if we don't get what we need, we're in trouble. So I guess my question back to you is, can it this system be built for $710 million?
So 810. So I'll just correct.
With vehicles,
Looking at the note. Yeah. So 810.
With vehicles, but I'm saying without vehicles. Yeah.
Let's just say with for simplicity.
Sure.
810. So we've got a system that works already. You know, we've got an 8-kilometer system with 6 vehicles that have been proven. Track switches, a system that works. So we know that it works. We've already have essentially half of a system. So this is about expanding the existing system we have and adding additional track to the south.
Okay.
So in that context, understanding that we already have half of the system built, yes.
So that's for tracks, vehicles that link to the link to the airport, and the maintenance facility. That's
correct.
All included, yep. In $810 million. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you both very much. Appreciate that.